Hello everyone, welcome to episode 55 of Realm and Ruin, a Warhammer podcast. A podcast that is so Warhammer that we only record when the bad moon is above us. Tis true. I'm your host Matt, and joining me as always, a guy who churns out Plague Marines quicker than Nurgle himself, it's Cameron. How you doing, mate?
I am doing great, thank you very much. I don't know, I feel he does more than 20 in like 6 to 12 months, but you never know. There's 40k. There's either zero or 1,000 of them.
Right, here we are, episode 55. And what is the plan? Well, the plan is to obviously discuss what hobby stuff we've been up to. Then we'll get stuck into the news again, which no doubt will be very 40k focused as per last episode. And then for the main lore topic, we are going to discuss the novella Severed, which we both should be very much looking forward to talking about because it's a belter. And then for the discussion topic, we are going to the Mortal Realms and discuss some of our favorite pets in AOS. Mm. You heard it here first. So before we get stuck into the episode, quick little bit of admin. Just a reminder, something we mentioned last episode, that Cold Open Stories are doing their June fast fiction. And as we said last time, we are part of the judging panel, which is an honor. And the theme for the June fast fiction, because I think last time it hadn't been picked at that point, and it now has been picked, and that's Everyone Can See It, which sounds awesome, Cameron. I'm really looking forward to judging what people write with that
theme. Oh, yeah. There's going to be some interesting creative ones for sure.
Definitely. So if you are a writer or just want to have a crack at it, go over to Cold Open Stories. So you've got a little bit. I mean, obviously, we're recording this now on the 14th of June. So by the time this goes out, there's probably not that long left. But, you know, it's 1,000 words. You can hopefully crank something out if you want to still enter. So looking forward to that. And as always, if you want to show how you or see how you can support us, all the notes will be down in this episode. And obviously on the podcast player of your choice. And as always, you can join our lovely Discord server, which is full of great, lovely people where we can have obviously conversations about the latest 40K reveals and talk about what we've had for dinner, if that's the conversation you want. So it's always free to join. And if you do join our Discord, you can ask us a question that we'll answer on the episode. And this is today's question. This comes from Chris, and he asks, do you guys generally prefer to go with existing factions or create homebrew chapters, storm hosts, craft worlds, etc.? So do you go for existing fiction or do you get to homebrew? What's your thoughts?
Well, this one's the easiest one I've ever done. I absolutely go with my own stuff. you might have noticed a trend over the last couple of years, which is I tend to customize the ever-loving shit out of everything I make. That is not limited to the physical meat space of models. My mind is constantly aflame with ideas for interesting fictional ideas and fictional factions all brewing up together. Honestly, it's so much fun. Like, I get having a very clear theme and setting laid out, and if you really love the characters, and you go like, no, I want to do my stuff about this guy, he's so cool, that's fine too, that's really awesome. But for me, nothing beats taking your little guys and making them really your little guys, you know?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's sort of what this hobby's about, really. I mean, again, like you said, there's always going to be difference of opinion on this. There's going to be people that, you know, want to just stick to the obviously what's already existing, which is cool because obviously there's some fantastic, you know, existing factions and you know, Space Marine chapters and things like that. But I think there's just something lovely about doing your own thing and you know, making it yours, because that's the beauty of this hobby. Anything out there, you can do it how you want. And I think that you almost get potentially the best of both worlds, because I was having the same conversation, I think, with Chris recently on our Discord, that because I think he was asking, you know, what would he do? Shall I do Marines in a, you know, particular chapter, or shall I, you know, go for, you know, homebrew? And I think one of the good things, you know, again, using Space Marines as an example, if you go homebrew, you have the advantage that from a lore and a tabletop point of view, you get what you want. What I mean by that is, okay, say you're toying with doing Imperial Fists, for example, and you think, well, shall I do Imperial Fists or shall I make them a successor chapter? Paint to me, make them a successor chapter, you know, from the way they look, you know, paint them in whatever scheme and design you feel you like. But then ultimately, from a tabletop perspective, you can still run them as Imperial Fists. They're just Imperial Fists in a different color, ultimately. And, you know, most tournaments and most places you play are quite cool with that, you know, that you go, well, you know, they're clearly, you know, Imperial Fists. They've got, you know, Imperial Fist, you know, shoulder pads. They're just in red because, you know, this particular, you know, group of Imperial Fists have gone red because of a campaign they're doing. You know what I mean? You can make it whatever reason you want. And obviously most places from a tabletop perspective only really care about that if you're, you know, trying to make them another chapter that's that clearly they're not. Yeah. Like, going, oh, these are Ultramarines. Yeah. Well, no, they've got Imperial Fists, shoulder pads, and they're red. They're clearly not Ultramarines. So it's things like that. Whereas if you make them Imperial Fists, like with yellow and everything like that, then you can't really step backwards from that. You know, so I think that's why I think homebrew is one of the best, because you get the narrative and you get the tabletop sort of flexibility, if that makes sense. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and like you said, you get to, you know, get to be creative, you get to be naming them, and obviously, like we'll see, especially in 40K with Crusade when that appears, that that's going to be a real sort of push for a lot of people. So, and again, it still applies to AOS. I suppose AOS is a bit more chilled, I think, in that side of things, you know, from a rules perspective, that, you know, most of the time you can be, again, really whatever you want. So, yeah, I think it's just nice to be creative. There's so much flexibility in 40K and AOS from a universe perspective that you've got so much to play with, that to me, use what's there existing as an inspiration, but do your own spin on it, because there's nothing better than that, I don't think, anyway. Well, there you go, Chris. We've answered it very decisively. Right, okay, I think already it's time to get stuck into hobby. Right, hobby time. So Cameron, we've had a few weeks to be getting on with things. I believe you've been down in the Underhive.
I've been down in a lot of places, but yes, it is the Underhive primarily. It's been a surprisingly busy 2 weeks, despite the fact that everything's sort of basically back to normal at work now and all that. But somehow I found the true work-life hobby balance, which is all hobby, all work, no other life. it's fine. We're doing fine. I found the secret to doing more hobby, which is play less video games. mostly, here's a little anecdote. Mostly because my PS4 wasn't displaying properly on the TV, like it was cropped slightly, like it was too big for the screen, just a tiny bit, so I couldn't see like HUD and stuff, and it was on everything. I couldn't watch YouTube without being annoyed that like words were being cut off the corners of the screen and stuff. And so I fixed that 3 days ago by changing it to the other HDMI port in the TV. simple stuff. But because of this problem, I got an inordinate amount of shit done, and I had a great time doing it, so I'm very happy about that, honestly. Again, I've had to do notes again. I feel it's becoming a regular occurrence. So I've split everything up into the various bits and bobs, and I will say it as such. So buying stuff. I've bought a fair bit of stuff, and I'm going to keep doing that, apparently. hey, we'll talk about it more in the news. I'm probably going to get the Indomitus box. That might be my last big hobby purchase, because I kind of want to save up for a PlayStation 5 at the end of the year, so we'll see how that goes once they actually announce a price for the damn thing. But in terms of Games Workshop hobby buying, I bought a few things. First off, I bought a book called Road to Redemption by Mike Brooks, which is a book set in Necromunda. I'll talk about what's in it later on when I talk about what I've been reading, but people should buy it. It's pretty good. I love Mike Brooks. He's great. I bought a big scenery brush because I want a big, nice, easy to handle brush to paint my Zone Mortalis walls with. I bought an Underworlds Beastgrave carry case, not because I'm going to play more Warhammer Underworlds, although I'd love to, but because it's really good for carrying Necromunda stuff around. So it's got my gang all packed up in it currently with like a tape measure, some dice, my gang cards, all that kind of stuff. I bought the book Engine War from Psychic Awakening. It's the first Psychic Awakening book I've bought. I'll talk about that in the reading section because I've read it. I've got thoughts. I bought a pack of Mirmorn Banshees, mostly to press mold their cloaks for my Night Tyrant that I'm building. And then yesterday I pre-ordered War of the Spider, Fabius Bile, and his latest book, Manflayer, because...
Nice.
It's Fabius Bile. How could I not? Like, we'll talk about it more in the news section. How could I not? Strength 7 possessed, just running around, tearing stuff up. I have a feeling that 9th is going to be the death of my make one big army thing. Like, I'll still keep adding to my 9th, I'll still keep adding to my Death Guard, but I think I'm going to do a bunch of, like, little 500 to 1,000 point projects from now on.
Yeah.
Because I want to do everything, and I'm tired of lying to myself.
Yeah, give in to it, Cameron, give in. The rest of us have.
Yeah. In terms of building, the bits I ordered from Tarot Model Maker arrived, which is super cool. So as a reminder, I've got like an extra leg joint for my Night Tyrant and a hip extension plus a new head, and a whole bunch of, Chaos Knight wound tracker disc things, which are super duper cool. I love mm-hmm. those. Looking forward to painting them up all nice and cool looking. Which means now the Night Tyrant is kind of close to fully assembled in terms of like the basic chassis. It's just all the decorating it and covering up all the ugly gaps now. So I finished building up the Thundercoil Harpoon, which is a ridiculously oversized gun. I've built the legs and it's in sort of a long sort of either striding or running forward pose, and it's going over like the sinking in burning chassis of a rhino just being pushed down into the earth. Because of course... and I'm pretty happy that it's not super stable, because I'm holding it all together with blue tack and all its weight's resting on one foot, but a bit of pinning and actual super glue will solve that very easily. So that's not really a problem. I started doing some press molding for the Banshee bits. I haven't yet pulled any of the, reproduced, cowls or shawls or whatever, the long floaty drapey bits of the Banshees. I haven't actually pulled any of those out of their little press molds yet, but when I do, I'm basically going to use them as like a sort of like a wedding veil kind of thing. So this rotting old veil over the chassis of the knight itself to help cover up gaps in the armor that I just don't want to fill in. Because it's a lot of extra work and no one's ever going to see it once it gets covered up, so it's fine. And then I've been gap-filling and experimenting with some different sort of priming and painting on my Zone Mortalis walls, so I'm just using Astro Granite, the texture paint, to, like, fill in some of the more egregious gaps between the bits of foam and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Over on the painting side, I've done some priming on the Zone Mortalis walls. I've got a big brush to paint them with. Haven't had a chance to do it yet. But I did finish painting the alternate loadout for my Goliath Leader, so the one with the heavy bolter is now completely painted up. Oh, wait, no, the one with the heavy bottle was the one completely painted up. The one with the bolt gun and the renderizer is now completely painted up, which I can say, yay, I've got a fully painted Goliath gang, like, completely 100% from start at only 1,000 credits. It's pretty cool.
Nice.
I'm very happy with them.
Lovely.
It's pretty fun. I have almost finished painting up the Murder Cyborg I bought, built, didn't buy it. You can't buy a Murder Cyborg. I built it. And I have mostly done it. And when I say mostly, I mean 100% of what I've done so far is contrast paints. Thanks, Brain, adding things up. I've only got to do some metallics, and the metallics are going to be the only thing that's not contrast on this little guy, which is pretty cool. And some extra highlighting with some like pallid witch flesh, but that doesn't really count because then I mix contrast into that, so it's all contrast at the end of the day, really. So I've gone with like a super pale skin with like some purple spotting underneath the skin color, sort of I've done the purple spots, then glazed the skin color back over to make it look like it's sort of like liver spotting at the back of the head. The idea being like this literal skin suit it's wearing is sort of getting old and rotting from the inside out. And it's grabbing a nondescript Goliath head, not painted to look like my gang's, because my gang will never lose again. it's not true. They lose all the time, but that's what makes Necromunda fun. And I've continued working on painting up my Night Rampager. It's getting there. The base is like 80% painted. Most of what I need to do is slap more texture paints and slime on it. I've done the building in sort of that deep greeny turquoisey marble kind of look for like the shrine buildings on it, which I really like. And I think I've got to give them old brassy coppery roofs covered in verdigris and stuff. I painted the little guy cowering for his life inside the beat up shrine and stuck him in place. I really like this knight. It's coming together really nicely. Hooray. This is one of the projects where I was the least confident about it at several points throughout, but now it's the same thing. Once things start coming together, once I start getting color on it, I feel a lot better about it, which is good because otherwise it would have been a very expensive mistake.
I think we all have moments like that. I think even, especially when you're building or you're kit bashing, you're converting and you think this just isn't working, like you've got this idea in your head, and then like I think especially if it's something that you do over several sessions, I suppose like everything, you have your good and your bad. Sometimes you sort of need to, like we've said before, you just need to walk away and go, right, this isn't real. Or you just need to think about it and go, no, things are cool, go back into it, you know, fresh start, fresh session, and get back to it. And then sometimes, or a lot of time, you can actually turn it around and it's actually, you know, is what exactly what you wanted in the end.
Yeah. And I think, hey, we're going to get introspective and philosophical from it. I think a big part of the creative process is coming to terms with and compromising with your ideal of the project you're working on and going, this is what I can do. This is what I want to aim for. Let's see how we can get these two to work together. And a lot of the times for me, I've had this idea and I've aimed for that idea and I've fallen just short, but not in a bad way, because falling just short is something similar but different, and different in a really good way to what I wanted. Like, all my knights so far are not exactly as I envisioned them. None of them are perfect by any standard, but by the standard I set while building them, absolutely not what I was aiming for. Like, they're close, but they're not exactly what I was aiming for, but I'm really happy with what they are. And same for almost every modeling thing I've done, except for like the really simple stuff is like switching around which direction sides are facing on Death Shroud and stuff. That's fine. That's, you don't need to think about compromising your goals on that one, like the simple stuff. But like big ambitious projects, don't let yourself get down. Take a break. You'll figure it out. And It takes a lot of willpower to bargain with yourself on that and go, okay, me, I can't do this yet, but we can do this instead, and to go, that's okay. But we learn every day in this hobby, apparently.
We do.
Look at this. Warhammer, it's good for your personal growth.
It's just good not for your soul.
Just not for your personal financial growth.
That's true. That's very true.
So that was my painting. I've painted Morgulis, I've kept on painting the knight, I've painted a murder cyborg mostly. Over to reading, I read Road to Redemption by Mike Brooks. Holy shit, that was a good book. I really liked that. the quick synopsis is, the main character is an ex-Cawdor ganger who was taken in by some Orlocks and lived for 13 years as just a handy little slime farmer assistant helping them out. One night he was sleeping off a real big booze off because he's got terrible PTSD from all the horrible things he did as a Cawdor gang member, and slept through the entire little settlement getting burned to the ground, and the children of the people who took him in were kidnapped. So off he goes on his merry way to get those dang kids back, and it's really, really good. Like, again, I like books that expand on things. The idea of he was taken in by the Orlocks, everyone goes, oh, the gang. I'm like, no, Orlock is a house. You can be an Orlock without being a gang member. And these guys are just like, they have no connection to the overall house. They're just Orlock by descent, basically. And everyone's able to recognize other people as in that same situation. Like, this little community was mostly Orlocks, but there was a guy called Quiet Tim with a Y, and he was a Goliath who was too gentle for the Forges, and so they cast him out, and he ended up in this little settlement way down in the Underhive, and all he did was farm some little plants and purify water for the settlement, and he never hurt anyone, and I loved him, even though we never directly saw him. We just heard about him secondhand. I love him. I'm really sad he dies right at the start when the entire town burns down. We never actually meet him, but sure, whatever. Focusing on, like, expanding culture, there are great interpersonal relationships here. Like, this main character, Zeke, forming these allegiances with people as he goes on this tear through the entire Underhive. You know, he's trying to step away from his violent past, but he's like, this is a sign that the only thing I'm good at is killing people and hurting people, and I need to save these children. And, like, it's called Road to Redemption. He's atoning for his past by, you know, saving the future, et cetera, is that general plot arc. But it's so good. It's a lot of fun. You go through different settlements. You meet a whole bunch of different people and how different people survive in the Underhive and all that. It's really cool. It's a great book. Everyone should read it. Not everyone. Be warned, it is like... I can't say it's emotionally damaging. It's a real downer overall. Mm.
Right.
Because life in the Underhive is awful and terrible. But that's how it is sometimes, yeah. You know? Yeah. So I'm looking forward to reading his next book, Brutal Cunning, when that comes out. Because that promises to be much less of a downer because it's just orcs being orcs. What's better than that?
Exactly. I must admit, I'm looking forward, because I have got Road to Redemption as well. I bought it a while ago, and like you, I really like what he does. I really liked Rites of Passage, which, like I said, is the one about the 40k navigator houses.
Yeah, and
like I said, you haven't read that one yet, have you?
I've not, it's on my list.
Definitely check it out. Again, it's that same sort of thing like you just said about Road to Redemption, where you're sort of seeing things from a different perspective and not everything is as it seems, and it's, you know, all the politics and all the sort of things that go with it as well. So yeah, I like the way he writes. I think he picks up on the things you wouldn't always, you know, be, you know, thinking about when you're picking up a novel like that. You know, it's not just your standard Necromunda affair. It's, you know, a bit more to it than that, which is really good. So I'm really pleased you said that, because I really want to read it myself at some point.
Definitely read it. I really loved it. In other reading news, I read Psychic Awakening Engine War. And I do now understand some of the complaints about these books being a little skint on the lore, but I actually really liked it. Like, overall, the rules in the book are cool. Like, Chaos Knights get some cool buffs, Imperial Knights get some cool buffs. Demons get some really cool stuff that, according to the demon community, doesn't actually help them too much, but there's some really cool stuff. Like, making exalted greater demons left and right, just toss them out, that's cool. The Mechanicus got a boatload of cool shit in this one. They're definitely walking away very happy with it. But the actual story stuff I really liked. It's basically a Magos finds a corrupted distress signal and realizes, hey, this is an old forge world that got abandoned. We thought there was no one there, but the signal is like, there's Chaos Knights and demons everywhere, and they've taken over the planet. And so grabs some Imperial Knights, grabs his Explorator fleet, ends up all the way over that planet, and starts attacking it, because, of course, the Fury. But that's all well and good. The battles are fine. There's some pretty cool stuff. But the really important things are, like, again, the thorough implications of this, because this, in my opinion, 100% implies there are Necrons just living and walking around as part of the Adeptus Mechanicus, and no one bats an eye. So he's here to test out something called the Valian device, which is essentially an anti-psychic energy bomb. Like, you set it, you run away, the timer goes off, and it just obliterates psychic potential within like a 3-mile radius or something. He sets this off while his Imperial Knight allies are still in range, and the consequence here is a bunch of knights from House Terran don't have ancestors left in their thrones anymore. Like, the ancestral psychic spirits get wiped by it.
Oh, no.
and the end of the book is the leader of House Terran there kidnapping this Magos, jumping on her ship, and driving away to torture him for what he did. Which is hilarious, like just stealing a Magos Dominus and walking away while all the Skitarii try and shoot the knight down to no avail. The thing is, he didn't build that device. A member of the Adeptus Mechanicus, who doesn't show any of their face or bionics, they're completely covered in robes, who doesn't communicate through the noosphere, who only talks verbally through like a vox speaker that you can't see, who is accompanied by tiny insectile servitors of very fine craftsmanship that don't look like anything else Mars produces, handed them this box and said, "This kills psychers." And I'm like, that's just a Necron walking around as part of the Adeptus Mechanicus.
Sounds like a big link. It's literally a Necron as well.
yeah, exactly. and you know, he's like, "Oh, where did this amazing technology come from?" And he's like, "Oh, it might as well have come from the Gates of Vaal. Don't think about it." And they go, "You mean the place where no one goes because people just randomly and mysteriously disappear there? That area of space in the Ghoul Stars where no one goes, which I'm pretty sure might have been the heart of the Necrontyr Empire at one point." Or something like that. Yeah, like just that, this little passage, this little side box of like three paragraphs about where the box came from got me going, "Oh my fucking God. Oh my God." Like, all the rest of the lore was great. It was fun. Like, you got knights crusading through swarms of demons to turn off this big radio emitter that's transmitting demonic frequencies out from the planet to convert nearby planets. You've got the Chaos Knights have built a fortress like Minas Tirith in Lord of the Rings with layered walls. Oh, and nice. when the Imperial Knights break through the walls, they've got all these traps and everything. And also they have traps where Imperial Knights walk past like a tower in the wall and the tower rotates to reveal an open space with Chaos Knights in it. So they do like the Scooby-Doo mansion wall, but with a goddamn knight in it.
Amazing.
It's so cool. There's a bunch of really incredible stuff in it. Just like, and this is fitting like less than 30 pages of lore, I'm pretty sure.
Oh,
like,
wow.
It's not a lot. It's not a lot of stuff, but it's good quality stuff. I really enjoyed reading it.
Mm.
And the implication is huge. And then the rest is rules. Like, yeah. it's not a tiny book by any comparison. It's bigger than like a couple of the codexes, I'm pretty sure.
Mm.
Like, I know for a fact it's bigger than the Harlequin Codex, but.
Yeah. Yeah, everything's bigger than the Harlequin Codex. Everything's
bigger than the Harlequin Codex. I really enjoyed it. Honestly, for my first Psychic Awakening purchase, I'm pretty happy with it. Even if the rules I get aren't mind blowing or anything, it's like 4 or 5 pages total for Chaos Knights, but they're fun, and that's all I want. I'm not a competitive player. Yeah, it's pretty good, honestly. really looking forward to War of the Spider after that, because even if it's this little chunk of lore, if they put something like that just as an offline on the side of the main page, out of the way, some people don't even read those things. They put Necrons walking around in the Adeptus Mechanicus as that. They're going to slip so much stuff in with Fabius Vile. It's going to be great.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I've been playing some Necromunda. Because of course I have. So first things first, I played the Necromunda solo mission called The Hunt, which is where your guys go down deep in the hive and hunt down an Ambot that's gone rogue. In this case, it was the Dung Beetle Knight from Kingdom Death, because I didn't have an Ambot model, but it's close enough. I sent a few guys down there, and they almost universally got beaten to death or melted in the face, except for the leader, who survived. Good on him. Matt just barely managed to make it through with one tactics card. So that was a lot of fun. It definitely feels, because I used like my starting gang list, it definitely feels like maybe it's more meant for when you're partway through a campaign and you're a little more kitted out. Because I rolled the minimum number of guys possible and it was really rough. Like, this thing shows up, it's allowed to shoot its melter guns in close combat because it's freaking out. If it downs someone and there's no one nearby, it'll just drag them off into the darkness, take itself off the board, take them out of action, and then you've got to start searching for it again. So the main mechanic here is, It doesn't start on the board. Your fighters have to spend actions to either give each other covering fire or to start looking around for it. And whenever anyone looks for it, there's a chance it shows up. So I actually spent my first turn. You make an intelligence check to search. I sat up a couple of guys giving covering fire, and then I was like, "Well, I'll fail all these checks." But when you fail, you roll really low on the table, and if you roll really low on the table, it shows up, so my other guys can attack it. I passed all my intelligence checks for the first turn, which is unlikely on Goliaths, to say the least. It's like an 8+ or a 9+ on 2d6. It's not good odds. And it didn't show up in the first turn. And then I searched with everyone again. It showed up right at the end of the second turn after all my guys had activated. Just grabbed two people, beat them into the ground, gave them permanent injuries, and then just kept steamrolling through my entire gang. Took the third out of five guys down, walked back off into the shadows, reappeared, took one guy out, walked back in the shadows. It's just it and my leader left. And yeah. Like that's the final showdown is him pushing it into this pile of toxic sludge to lower its toughness and just beating it over the head with a stick. it was a lot of fun, honestly, and went pretty smoothly. For like a solo player thing, those are usually a little clunky. I recorded everything in detail, and I'm currently in the process of editing that out into like a little battle report. I'm gonna take some nicer photos. So when that's done, in the next week or two, I'll send that over to Matt, and he can put it up online on our website for us.
Yeah.
So we can have content on the website. But that's not the important Necromunda I played. The important Necromunda was last night. I stayed out until like 12:30 in the morning because we, Alan, the guy I've been playing some Necromunda with, are starting up a campaign with... four of his friends who play Necromunda. Those friends have just finished an old school Necromunda campaign, like the original version. And so they're jumping into the new edition. So we got together, we had a four player, match to sort of get people into the rules, understanding how the new edition works and stuff. And it was really, really fun. So there was my Goliath gang, there was another Goliath gang, there was a corpse grinder gang, which is, and there was an Esh gang. And our goal was the guilds have been wiping out this chaos cult that was trying to rise up, but while they're busy fighting most of the cultists, all our gangs were hired individually. We weren't told about the other gangs to break into the cult's secure vault and shut down whatever they're using to power up all their guys. They've got like a machine in there or something.
Yeah.
It turned out to be a brain in a jar, of course. Chaos. So there's a few Chaos Cultist sentries walking around. I'm going to call them massively inefficient sentries. Like, whenever they rolled to see how far they could see, they never got over about 5 inches. So they didn't spot anyone until I shot one of them. first few turns were people just sort of cautiously advancing up, trying to get towards this vault in the middle of the board. And then I went, no, this is taking too long. Shot a guy with a shotgun, the shot just rings out and everything turns to absolute chaos immediately. Like the corpse grinders and the Eshers start messing with each other. Like there's a smoke grenade goes down, and on one side of the smoke grenade is a corpse grinder with the saw on a bunch of wires that you can whip around at like a 4-inch reach. But on the other side of the smoke is the Esher leader with a shock whip just whipping through the smoke as well. Because you can make melee attacks through a smoke cloud, even though it blocks line of sight. Mm-hmm. So they're just trying to whip each other to death from opposite sides of the smoke grenade. Absolutely stupid. Amazing. My guys are playing it smart. Because I figure my Goliath leader is actually a 5+ intelligence. So to get an int check, you roll 2d6, add them together. So a 5+ is pretty fucking good, honestly. Mm-hmm. So he's acting tactically. So he runs everyone up. We play a tactics card that when people work together, they move faster. So suddenly we get this burst of speed, run over to the door, and he completely whiffs his intelligence check to open the door at the control panel. And so all the other guys in the gang get together, squat, and start just lifting it up, because you can either use a panel or you can do a combined strength check to lift it. And it took until the third guy to actually lift the goddamn thing.
Oh, wow.
At which point, I was the first into the vault. I was really excited. The problem was, I was the first into the vault, and so I opened the door and looked directly into the face of a servitor with a heavy bolter, just pointed at me. It fires Overwatch, fortunately completely whiffs its shots. I managed to hit it with a stray shot, I knock it down, and then next turn just turn it into paste. I was really scared, and then it just didn't do anything. I was like, okay, sure. At this point, there's like a single Corpse Grinder cultist. No, two Corpse Grinder cultists left. It's the leader and one of the champions. The champion at this point is Movement 10. Because he has a skill where every time he takes someone out, he gets an extra inch of movement for the rest of the game. So he's just been killing a whole bunch of Escher and just starts beaming himself around the battlefield because, you know, he makes charges and so he adds extra movement. And then he somehow ended up from halfway across the board to the other halfway across the board in melee with one of my guys. And I was like, what the fuck just happened? Unfortunately, the other Goliath gang tears down their door, marches in, smashes the brain in a jar, and so they won, but only just. The highlight of the game for me was, quote-unquote, the dream, which was there was a single Chaos Cultist with a long rifle on top of, like, this little watchtower, and at the base of this watchtower was the Escher Juve, and all she wanted was if she could roll a 5+ on a D6, she could make her charge up that ladder and throw that cultist off the top of the tower with a knockback attack. And she spent the entire game trying to do that and never made it. It's like everyone agreed, like, okay, we'll just leave that Juve alone. She's just trying to climb that ladder every single turn and just never makes it. Which is a shame, because that was also the only Chaos Cultist that was doing anything. Just knocking people down left and right with a long rifle. Again, didn't actually take anyone out, but he was annoying. Then we went through the post-game stuff. Sure, the Corpse Grinder leader got 8 experience over that game, but also 3 people from his gang would have permanently died if we were in an actual campaign. The moral of the story is to play a little more conservatively, even if you're raving lunatics worshipping corn, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it was a lot of fun. It was nice to meet everyone. It's been a while. Yeah. Hey, it's been a while since I went to a thing and met a bunch of new people that I'd never met before. It turned out all right. I liked it.
Nice.
And it turns out one of them is, do you know of a guy called Slave to the Whip, WIP?
No, not familiar with them.
So you should check him out on Instagram because he makes the world's most incredible Necromunda terrain. Turns out he was the guy playing Corpse Grinder Cults. He's a really good painter. He's a great modeler and kit basher as well, which is awesome. Seems like a really nice guy too. And so, you know, we've been chatting now. And like he organizes a whole bunch of like the painting competitions over here in Western Australia as well, apparently. And obviously none of those are going on currently, but, it was cool. Like, he might be my gateway into actually doing, bigger community things, but we'll see about that. That's a next year problem. It was really nice. We've been assigned our matches to do over the next couple of weeks. So I've got to fight the other Goliath player, which is going to be interesting. For Necromunda in the campaign, the way we're doing it to make things easy is each match, we randomly determine who's fighting who, and we randomly determine which territories are up for grab for each game. So it just so happens that the two Goliath gangs are going to fight over the very good Goliath-specific territory. So I really hope I win that game because it's a slag furnace, so it gets all the runoff metal and stuff, so you get a bit of extra money. But if you're a Goliath, you get a lot of extra reputation for being in charge of it because people are like, oh, those Goliaths are really in charge. They took control of that forge and stuff. And every game, there's a chance of you just recruiting a Juve or a Ganger for free and just adding them to your roster permanently. So I really want that. We're doing a campaign now on a fortnightly basis, so I guess I'll have at least a one game and episode update, hopefully, if all goes so well.
Yeah,
it's really fun. I'm really excited. I'm going to tweak my gang just a little bit before we actually start, but I feel pretty confident in my chances here. I hope we'll do okay. We'll see how it goes. It will take probably until about the end of the year, but... that's because like things are on a fortnightly basis and you need to go through like 10 cycles total, so it's about 20 weeks, so it's roughly the rest of the year, but that also means we get to take our time and enjoy it, and there's no pressure to do like three games a week or something crazy like that. No, no. One game of Fortnite I can definitely do. yeah, and that's my hobby. I've done so much. I'm just looking at the time now. I've done too much.
Enough of me. No, never too much.
Wait, there's one more thing I have to speak about. I have to speak about my hobby highlight of the episode of the week, but it's of the Fortnite.
Of the Fortnite.
there is a person on our Discord by the name of Cryin Mo, whose work I initially noticed on Reddit, actually, because he has taken the initial Shadespire Stormcast warband, Steelhearts Liberators.
Steelhearts Champions, I'm gonna say.
Steelhearts Champions, yeah. And he has taken them and done a super dark and gritty take on Stormcast, and I absolutely love it. Like this color scheme of like this old super weathered bronze. They've all got like skull, like beast skulls on the helmet. Two of them have auric brute weapons.
Yeah.
So the guy with the big two-handed hammer has a big two-handed gore hacker, and the Steelheart stand-in himself just has this massive auric axe. And my favorite part is they each have a little blurb. So Angerad's become Polyxena, the sunken Valkyrie, wearing her father's mask and all that kind of stuff. The two-handed hammer guy, I forget his name, is Sir Donald, the Time Stalker, Bloodwalker, etc. They've got these cool things. And then Steelheart himself is Captain Blood. I don't know where that head's from, but it's got, like, gritted, pointed teeth.
Yeah.
I have no idea which set that's from. He looks super cool. These are absolutely astounding. I've seen Grimdark Stormcast before, but there's something about the styling here is just so perfect.
Yeah.
I love it.
It is so good.
He calls them. There we go.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's gorgeous. And it came out of nowhere, didn't it, really, on our Discord.
Yeah.
It just popped up in our gallery channel. It's like, whoa, what's this? This is amazing. It's so good. I love it. I must admit, I'm a massive fan of that sort of style of painting where it's pretty, when I say it's all one color, it's not all one color, but where the shades are very similar, where, and then they just pick and certain colors are picked out. When I do my hobby highlight at the end of my hobby section, which I'll send you a link for in a minute, it's very similar. What my pick is, it's the same sort of, you know, sort of theme really. And it's gorgeous. I love it. It's very, very grim, but very appropriate as well. It's great. Really, really good. So now you've been a busy lad, and I must admit, the one thing, you know, going back to Necromunda, is I love the fact that like every bat rep that, you know, or a game that you've played or you read other people playing, it's always just fun. There's always memorable moments and things like that. Whereas, you know, I know obviously that can apply to any other games, but I think Necromunda's so perfect for the way, you know, for that sort of memorable moments that you can always talk about. And it just sounds great.
there's something about the system. It's got enough jank in it. It's not competitive at all. You can't play Necromunda competitively, and because of that, it's got the right level of jank for just the craziest shit to happen. It's so good.
Amazing. Right, okay. Well, before I get on to my hobby section, we'll do the hobby tip of the episode. Cameron, have you heard of Sprugoo?
Oh, I've heard the word of Sprugoo, but I've never ventured into that realm myself. Please elaborate on the Sprugoo.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's again, like you, it's something I've heard, you know, people mention on the grapevine, but it was something that actually cropped up in conversation on our Discord where I think it was Drew that sort of started talking about it in context of, you know, advice, you know, it's and such, and then, you know, it started getting the ball rolling, and then you start watching YouTube videos and things like that. And it's something that I must admit, I'm really looking forward to try. So apologies if you're listening and you're like, yeah, I know what Sprugoo is. Come on, get with the times. But obviously a lot of people probably don't know what it is. And basically the premise behind it is you take a pot of glue, perfect example, which seems to be is the Tamiya extra thin cement that a lot of people use. So you take that, it's the one in the, you know, in a sort of a glass pot with a brush on the lid. And basically it's very simple. You take bits of sprue. So you cut, you know, all the sprues that everyone has got lying around, you start cutting up into little pieces. You can use plaster card as another alternative. I think it's whatever you feel like you want to use, but obviously Sprue makes sense in the context of our hobby, because obviously most things you use are, you know, Sprue plastic. So basically you cut the bits of Sprue and then you just literally drop it into the pot and then, you know, seal it, you know, put the lid back on and then leave it overnight. And what should happen is the Sprue plastic should melt into the glue. And as you would imagine, when you come back the next morning, you should have this gloopy, you know, consistent, you know, glue basically. And the idea behind it is it's very good at filling in gaps or seams on models, because obviously in effect you're basically brushing on what, you know, the same sort of material that the model's made of. Because obviously, you know, some people use green stuff, some people use liquid green stuff, or we've got like the Vallejo putty and things like that. And obviously they have their pros and cons, but obviously they suffer with things like shrinkage and things like, you know, you fill a gap in with some of it and it dips slightly when it dries, you know, all that sort of stuff. Whereas from what people are saying, again, I've not tried this firsthand, I will be very soon when I make my own sprue goo, is that, yeah, it just makes a better finish. You know, it fills it in better. You can then obviously just sand it down. And yeah, and it's in the fact, especially if you use the Tamiya glue way, you can just, because you've already got a ready-made brush for it. Best thing to do, go on YouTube. There's lots of videos about it, because obviously you want to sort of understand like what consistency you want, you know, so I do you add more sprue less or whatever, because obviously that will depend on it, but it looks a really handy thing to use, I must admit.
Yeah, I've always wanted to try it. I've never come across quite the perfect opportunity to, honestly. Like, I've usually just solved those problems by flooding the gap with plastic glue and praying for the best. Again, we'll talk about this in the news, but I think with some of the future projects I might be doing, I might need to be a little more cleanly about it, and so this might be a better idea.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like you just said, it depends on what you would be needing it for. Obviously, this is just another potential tool in your arsenal, ultimately. Like I said, for some people, it may not be appropriate. But I think, like, for example, from what I've seen in photos and such, like, it's perfect for, I don't know, say, Stormcast, where, you know, especially on the easy-to-build kits, where you put them together, and then you've still got that seam that's going right down the middle of their shoulder pads. You know, it's perfect for that, because then you can just brush it over it. It fills in the gap. File it down a bit. And in theory, it should give you potentially a better finish than some of the others, like, you know, like liquid green stuff and such like. But again, it's like everything. Just, you know, it's something that you can give a go. And if it works for you, if it doesn't, then, you know, it's only ultimately a pot of glue that you've probably lost out on, because obviously, you know, everyone's generally got sprue hanging around. So that's the hobby tip of the episode. Right. Okay. What have I been up to? Well, I've been sort of doing bits. I've had a funny last few weeks, really. I think I've been getting into other things that aren't Warhammer. I say getting into other things, I've been sort of concentrating on other hobbies that's not just always Warhammer. Like, again, I've been watching a lot of Last Kingdom on Netflix over the last few weeks. I've watched all four series, so I've been spent having a lot of family time. So my output is probably not as big as yours at the moment, Cameron, but I've done a fair few bits as well. So hobby-wise, I have put some incursors together, because at the moment I'm concentrating on my wolves for hopefully a lovely crusade they're going to go on to in the 40k universe. So I've built so I built some incursors, nice models to build, straight out of the Prophecy of the Wolf box set that came out recently. And yeah, nice unit, they go together really well. Obviously I've been wolfing them up, so I've given them alternative heads. I've used some of the ones out of the Space Wolf pack kit, and what I, for the rest of them actually, so I've only done a unit of five of them, so that I've sort of mixed them up a bit, but basically for the ones that aren't the pack leader, the sergeant, basically I've given them Devastator heads and it works really well, because I mean, I don't dislike the Incursor heads, but I just think the Devastator heads just work quite nicely with it. And obviously they got obviously like, you know, bionic eyes and sights and antenna and stuff like that, which works nicely with Incursors. So again, I just did it just to make it a bit different. So they're all built, ready to to paint. I then also put together a Phobos Wolf Lord. So that is basically a captain in Phobos armor. So I wolfed him up and I'm really happy with him, actually. I put him on Reddit, got a lot of good feedback from people. So it very simple. So it was just a very simple little kit bash, really. So predominantly he's the same sort of model, but I gave him a Reaver helm, you know, because Reaver heads just make everything look better. And I gave him the Space Wolf Championship belt that comes with the Space Wolf pack. Mm-hmm, so that's basically, if you ever see the Space Wolf pack box, they come with this this belt that you can, that's got a couple of knives on it that you can put on basically any character. So I put that on it to make him look proud. A few, you know, bits of fur on his guns. I gave him a little ponytail, so I cut a ponytail from the Space Wolf heads and put it on the back of his head as well. Very simple. Didn't sort of go overboard with it, but again, he's going to be part of my Crusade force. Nicely going into that, I bought a box of Eliminators. So the obviously the Primaris ones with the snipers. So I've decided to kit them out as with the LAS fusils, so the little mini LAS cannons, basically, because my thought process is these are a unit that I'm going to expand my crusade with. So basically, at the moment, this could change, but my sort of initial 25 PL crusade force is going to be 5 Reavers, 5 Intercessors, 5 Incursors, so that's 15 PL. It will be the Phobos captain at 5 and either a wolf priest or a rune priest for the other 5. And then my thought process is, once the crusade goes on, and then I think, right, I'm going to probably do with a bit of anti-tank, that's when the eliminators will come in. So that's why I've started getting them prepped. Really nice kit. And I'll tell you what, when you build them and then you put a old marine next to them, they look so big compared to an old marine. They really do.
Stupidly big.
Yeah.
They picked the tallest marines to be the stealthy ones.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I mean, obviously, I know you can say that when, like, you know, on my table here, I've got intercessors versus, you know, an old style marine that I've used for, like, wolf priests and wolf lords. But, like I said, the eliminators just are massive for some reason. I don't know why particularly they are. But they especially the fact they're in Phobos armor as well. But they are. So, I've started building those. We'll wolf them up a bit. I don't think it's a kit you can do that much with, really, you know, from a kit bashing point of view. So it'd be minimal wolf stuff I'll put on them, but they're on my table at the moment. Talking of wolf priests and such like, I have started redoing my wolf priest, because I did a wolf priest a little while ago, kit bash, and I was just looking at him and I was thinking, like we were saying earlier about when you sort of look at a model and think, oh, this isn't quite turning out how I thought it would. And that's sort of where I went with my wolf priest. He wasn't bad by any chance, but it was just the fact that I wasn't overly happy with him. So I thought, well, you know, let's rip him up. I literally just ripped his torso off, ripped his head off. Luckily, nothing damaged. It was just one of those where, you know, you can rip it off and then just clean it up with a knife. And so, I just redid him yesterday. So again, I give him a Reaver head because again, it makes everything look cool. And and I just gave him a better Crozius as well, because obviously a wolf priest is basically a Space Wolf chaplain / apothecary. And I gave him better posed legs, as in I found some, I think they're from Vanguard Vets kit, where he's leaping because he has got a jump pack as well. So again, he's just posed a bit better. So the only snag, because I put him on Reddit and again I got some lovely feedback from people, and the only thing I didn't realize is that one of his shoulder pads is on the wrong way. And in the sense that, obviously, it's one with a wolf, you know, the Space Wolf logo on it. Whereas the wolf's head should be pointing, like, the nose forward. See what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas in the way, because I think I took it from the Death Watch kit, where obviously the Death Watch, it would go on the right shoulder, whereas obviously the Death Watch shoulder pad would go on the left shoulder. So I've put it on his left shoulder. So it's going the wrong way. And I was like, never mind. I think I've done that with one of the other models as well, because I've probably used the same shoulder pad. So I'm just going to, I'll rip it off.
That's fine.
And it's fine. Yeah. You know, luckily I've not started priming them yet. So it's fine. Whatever. So that's another to-do list thing for this next week. So that's what I've been working on. So yeah, it's coming. It's been nice to focus on something and have a plan for it, because again, I don't know when I'm going to see the light of day, in the sense of, you know, post lockdown at the moment for myself. Yeah. So I don't know when I'm going to do it. So I'm just thinking, if I can just chip away at these Space Wolves, then, you know, by the time I can actually go and play, you know, in outside of my house, then they'll be sort of ready to kick off. So, buying wise, I've got some more Wolves on the way, because I did have an order going through, which I basically returned because I've been waiting a month because of the whole, you know, stock issues at GW. Yeah. So I thought, right, okay, refund that, place a different order with stuff that's actually in stock. So hopefully soon I will be getting a box of Wolfguard Terminators, because they're lovely.
Terminators.
I'm thinking of kicking them out with Thunder Hammers and Storm Shields. I don't know yet. That's sort of the way I'm thinking with them. I've got the Dreadnought kit on the way. So that's the one that can build Murderfang and Bjorn the Fell-Handed and such like. Awesome. I'm leaning towards Murderfang because it's Murderfang.
That's fair.
That's justification enough. So yeah, I don't know yet, but that's the build I'm leaning towards when it arrives. And I've got a Phobos Librarian on the way as well. I've already got, well, which will be a Rune Priest in Space Wolves. I've got a normal one built, as in a non-Primaris one built, but the Phobos one comes with different powers. So I just thought it'd be nice to have, you know, because this is for Crusade. So obviously you want a pool of models to pick from. So I thought, well, get a Phobos one as well, because again, it's just a nice variation and, you know, different powers and such like. So I think, and also I've got some plasma cannons on the way, because I'm going to carry on building my long fangs and I want them all to have plasma cannons. So two come in the box. So I've ordered, the good thing is with eBay, it's perfect for finding that sort of stuff. So I've got another two plasma cannons on the way to deal a lot of plasma death to my opponents, whenever that may be. What else? Reading wise, I read Severed, obviously, because we're talking about it shortly. And it was fantastic, but we'll talk about that later.
Yes.
And I also pre-ordered Manflayer, because obviously that is out next week. And so I've pre-ordered that on Audible. And it is probably one of the two main novels I've been looking forward to this year. The two main I'm looking forward to, putting aside now the new 9th edition stuff, because obviously that's recently, but the two I've been looking forward to is Manflayer and Darkness in the Blood, which is the Devastation of Baal sequel.
Yes.
So I'm going to be a happy boy soon reading that one, or listening to it is probably the better way. Lastly, also, is we've now concluded our AOS D&D campaign on Discord.
Yeah.
So as I've said before, this is my first time playing D&D. We went through, I think, what is, like I said, believe is the starter campaign for 5th edition D&D. And like I said, what we're doing is been playing D&D with an AOS sort of theme and skin on top, basically, which has worked really well. And we just had, it's one of the best times I've had. And, you know, and again, there'll be people listening that obviously play tabletop RPGs. I'm like, well, of course it's fun. It's one of the best things in the world. And it's been great to actually get into it and actually play this sort of stuff. Because again, I know you and I played Wrath and Glory last year, or actually, no, it'd be year before, actually. You know, it's been really good to play something like this consistent and actually see what everyone else raves about. You know, why is everyone raving about this side of things? So that's been really, really good. And it was, so I played Melagora Ravenborn. I was a witch elf, rogue, basically, proper glass cannon, because we had no real tanks in our group. It was just me, trying to kill stuff before they killed us, basically. That was the approach we took. And, I had some great moments. I think we hit about level 4 or 5 sort of before the campaign or the scenario finished. So I got to be an assassin. You know, I've got to sort of, you know, I think I got at level 3, so I got to be an assassin. Yeah. So I was, you know, doing sneak attacks and crits in certain situations, which were amazing. And it was great, actually, because on a personal level, because I got to sort of finish off the campaign, in the sense that we were playing the campaign where you have to take out the Black Spider. And who's like, you know, the final boss, so to speak. And it was really good is that I launched myself at him, and I had my main hand and my off hand. Right, so I've got a main hand as a magical sword called Talon. My off hand is a silver rapier. And then I managed to double natural crit with both of them. I managed to roll a 20 on both hands.
Wow.
Actually, well, this is the funny thing, actually. What I did is I rolled a natural 20 on the main hand. I then rolled for the off hand, got something else. I think I didn't even get a hit. It was like a 10 or something. Mm. I then used, because I had lucky as one of my skills, which means I could re-roll. I then rolled a 20 on my offhand, and I managed to do like 45-50 damage on him because I was rolling loads of damage dice and completely decapitated him. And it was just such a lovely way to finish the campaign.
That's awesome.
So that was really good. And what's even more exciting is after doing that, and we started last night, is we've started our Soulbound campaign. So proper AOS, not D&D with the theme. It's proper AOS. And so we had our session zero last night, where most of it was focused around building our characters. And then we basically, for the last hour, started off the actual campaign, but very much a very simple, just get used to fighting. We're basically fighting some Skaven. And it's really good. It's hard to sort of get used to it, because obviously you're used to rolling, you know, D20s and such. And obviously Soulbound is D6 mechanics. And obviously it's it's the test side of things. And it's also got the sort of 40K, sort of strength toughness thing, you know, where you need to roll, you know, where you compare, you know, the two results and go, well, I have good melee, you have poor defense, therefore I need to roll a 3 because I'm higher, you know. I think it's that sort of way of playing. So it's, again, it's just compared to D&D, it's quite different. But so far, from the session zero we had, I'm really excited. So I'm playing, I've thought I'd play something different. So I've gone from, like I said, Melagora, my witch elf rogue, to a Stormcast. I'm basically playing a Knight Zeros named Oren Aethersun. And I just thought I'd go for something completely different. So I'm basically a flying healer sort of class, nice. Really. And I'm like I said, I'm really excited about how this is going to go. We've got, I think, 6 of us plus Martin as our DM as well. And hopefully next session we'll have our official first main session, you know, because as I said, it was zero last night. And I'm really excited to play Soulbound. I'm really looking forward to it. It looks a really cool system. So that's been me.
That's awesome.
So just to wrap up my hobby section and my hobby highlight, I will send you a link now, Cameron, so you can sort of see it for yourself. So I found this guy, I think, on Twitter. He does a blog called The Empyrean. Apologies if I'm pronouncing that wrong. I will put the link in the show notes. I think I saw one of his posts, like I said, on Twitter, and like I said, I found out he's got a blog. He's got, again, like the other guy you were saying, he's got an Instagram. Does what he seems to do, very much a theme of most of the models are obviously kit bashes and conversions. He likes to do them in black and white, sort of black and white and grey sort of scheme, and then pick out very subtle colours. I've sent you the link to what he's named his Convent of Her Lady's Silent Sigma. So basically he's a Sigma force, obviously with a theme of using Sisters of Battle from 40K, which I've started doing myself with my Season Sigma as well. And they look fantastic. Like I said, he's using like a Sister of Battle as an anointed for what would be his Phoenix Guard in air quotes.
Is that the old Celestine model?
It looks like it.
I think it is.
It looks gorgeous. Wow. I just love the color scheme. And I don't think it shows in this post, but in one of the others, he started doing assassins for his City of Sigmar. Using like some of the guys from Warcry and things like that, and put them on really cool poses and such like. And they're just really cool. Again, I love it for two reasons, because I love, as you know myself, with Cities of Sigmar, I love where they're so different, where you're completely using a different force to do them, which again is the flexibility of Cities of Sigmar. But I love he's got that sort of Blanchett Sue style, you know, painting as well, where, like I said, it's all greys and blacks and then just picking out very subtle bits of colour. I love it. I absolutely love this sort of style of doing things, which I know it's not quite the same as what you were saying for your hobby highlight, but it's that sort of same realm where you sort of, you know, it's sort of very subtle sort of ways of doing things. And
that's so cool. Yeah.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
Oh, I've got to be on this website for a while.
I was going to say, he's got an Instagram. I know you're on it, so it's probably best to follow him on there and see all his cool stuff. So yeah, really impressed with it. But again, like I said, for our hobby highlights each episode, the links to their stuff will be in the description as well. So very cool indeed. Very inspiring. Right. So yeah, that's been our hobby section. Like I said, we've been doing stuff. Stuff's getting done. Yeah. I think we'll take our first little break now. And when we return, we'll get stuck into the news. Be surprised, it's gonna be 40K focused.
Yeah.
Back soon. Right, news time. Definitely 40K time.
Yes.
as expected, 9th edition, the new edition, is still dominating things at the moment. So, Cameron, kick us off, mate. What's going down?
All right. Last night, or yesterday afternoon, depending upon your time zones, or yesterday morning, I guess, for some of the Americans, we had another 40K reveal stream. These things are coming thick and fast. They're never ending. There's been 40k reveal streams of some kind, honestly, almost every night for the last week, which has been fun. But this one was, what's in the box? What's in the box?
What's in the box?
We could go play school or we could go seven. I think I went seven and you went play school. So what's in the box is referring to what's in the Indomitus launch set box. Now make no mistake, friends and family, this is no mere starter set.
Yeah, you said launch set, didn't you, Cameron?
Yeah, this is specifically a set aimed for veterans of the hobby already. It contains no dice. It contains no rulers. Contains none of the other handy dandy little things you might want or need. No, sir. This is for veterans. This is 61 push fit models with a limited edition core rule book and other small book detailing those model stats and lore. This box looks freaking incredible.
It does.
I'm hyped. Like, I had just convinced myself I was not gonna get it. And then they showed off everything in it and went, ah, I've made a mistake. I am going to get that, actually. So this is a launch set, a launch box to celebrate the beginning of 9th edition. Mm-hmm. As such, this is technically, with big air quotes around the words, technically a limited edition. However, they say they've made more than enough. So this is going to be, I'm going to call this the watershed moment. This is the testing of Games Workshop's ability to rise to Box Fever's constant aggression towards the company. Because if this thing runs out in less than a day, I don't think people will be very happy.
I sort of get the impression that it's, again, I think I said this in Discord last night, I think it's going to be a bit like Shadow Spear. So Shadow Spear obviously was when they released the Vanguard, you know, the Phobos Primaris, and obviously the new Chaos Space Marines in one set. And it was one that, you know, that was not difficult at the time to get hold of, but then all of a sudden they stopped making it and it went. Where obviously we know that this is a limited run, whereas we didn't know Shadow Spear at the time was a limited run as such. You know, it sort of just came out of nowhere. Whereas I think with this is a bit like what you just said then, and what they've said is that I don't think this will be hard to get hold of. I think if you want a copy, you will get hold of a copy. With realistically, it's just that I think there won't be that much excess. You know, as such, you know, so people that want three boxes, which there will be people, because there'll be people that will be, you know, wanting to split it and such, and obviously use it to sort of double up on things, that may be a struggle, but maybe not. It's just, I just think that for the, you know, X amount of time, few weeks, maybe a month, it'll be should hopefully be pretty easy to get hold of. And then, you know, if you're a bit late to the party, then you may struggle. So I think as long as you're sort of willing to get it sort of within the first, you know, period of it coming out, you know, the first week or two, I don't think it'll be a problem. I think after that, you may start struggling. But Yeah, it's difficult to say because we don't know what numbers they're talking about.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This also comes together. Some rumors about the potential price of the box was setting it at maybe £120 UK, which is significantly more than the actual starter set Dark Imperium. But with this as a launch set, not a starter set, I can see that being more realistic. So it's going to be a little more expensive, but honestly, looking at it, I would be happy to. I will. Because, like, I mean, hey, £420, if you break it down, that's less than £2 per model in the box, plus a free limited edition version of Ninth Ed Core rules.
Exactly. And another thing to interject as well is if it is £120, your average start collecting box is £60. So effectively, this is two start collecting boxes plus the book, which will be worth £35, you know, based on everything else. So that's a good deal.
Even more, it's a limited edition. It might be worth £70.
Well, yeah, that's true.
And how Games Workshop does book pricing. So let's have a quick smash cut of all the cool shit in this box. Because, wow, I guess there's 61 minis in this box. That is so many.
And 61 new minis as well.
Yeah, they're all brand new, is the really impressive bit. First off, we'll look at the Primaris side of things, because, wow, these guys are cool. We have a Primaris captain with a relic shield and a mastercrafted power sword. This is the man with a skeleton on his shield. He's super
I love this model so much. It's probably one of my favorite models of this set. I love the captain. I mean, he's very busy. I was saying to the guys on stream yesterday that it reminds me of Dark Angels Horus Heresy models, you know, where you sort of look at them and think, oh, they look a bit complicated. But I absolutely love this model so much. He's sexy. He's a sexy model. Yeah. It's just so good. I love the pose. The shield is massive. I mean, look at the size of that shield. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. But I think that my favorite bit, which I know is divided to some people, I love the helm. I love the fact that the face guard sort of, you know, goes up over his head. I love that. You know, we've not really seen it in that sense. We've seen the other way, where obviously they take the top of the helmet off and leave the bottom, whereas this is the other way around. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, even for the people who don't like that particular helmet, this model comes with three head options. You have helmet with visor up, helmet with visor down, and no helmet, as is tradition for anyone in a position of command. he's really cool. Because on the stream, we got to have a quick look at the sprues, so I've been poring over those as well, some screenshots of them. I think he's really cool. Like, I like the idea of him just standing there in a commanding position, just holding his shield up casually in front of him, just to make sure he doesn't get shot. He's really cool. We have the Primaris Lieutenant, the Blade Guard Lieutenant, with his Neo Volkite Blaster, his Power Sword, and his Storm Shield. We've seen this guy already. He looks super cool.
Yep.
We have my favorite sculpt from the box, on the Primaris side at least, is the Primaris Chaplain.
Agreed. Best one.
Oh my god. I don't mind the current Primaris Chaplain, but he's a little too edgy for me, and not got... He looks like Reaper from Overwatch is my main problem with him. Like, he just doesn't... That's fine, and that's really cool, and I really like him. He's a great model, but he looks like Reaper from Overwatch, so he's poisoned in my mind. This is a chaplain. Oh my god. This is so perfect. Down to the bare head, which normally I would say, no, skull helmet is required for chaplain, but this bare head is beautiful. He's got the Terminator, like, with the skin peeled away to reveal the bionics underneath.
It's beautiful.
God, he's awesome. Yeah,
he really is. I get a bit, going back to the current Primaris Chaplain, I'm a bit mixed on him as well, more for the reason that I was saying to the guys that I don't find him bulky enough. He's a bit too... like, the posing on him is a bit weird. His Crozius is a bit slender. Thin. His actual armor, you know, he doesn't... Whereas this looks more like a bulky Marine chaplain.
Yeah.
You know?
This is a thick Marine.
Yeah.
These are all thick Marines, actually, looking at them. They've all got really, really heavy leg armor, which... Love it.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Judiciar, who is a branch of chaplain. Like, so This is another kind of chaplain, but he's completely different. He is a very good swordsman. and carries something called a tempor mortis. Mm. Something to do with manipulating time and killing people with that big old hourglass of his. Of course, no mention of the rumors that he's got bonuses against quote-unquote firstborn Marines, but we'll see. Honestly, I think he doesn't. I think that's fake at this point. But
yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Although it would be really cool if it was real. But he still looks cool. I still want to give him a different head. I want to slap like a regular chaplain head on him. I think would be good.
Yeah, or a Reaver.
Or a Reaver. Everything's better with Reaver. Exactly. Blade Guard veterans, we have seen. They look pretty cool.
Yeah.
Can't say no to them. The Blade Guard Ancient. So we don't have a banner. We have a big standard this time of a winged skeleton. He's covered in robes and tabards, and he is holding a hand on like a little loop as his only apparent weapon. I'm interested to see if he has an actual weapon hidden behind those robes somewhere, or if he just slaps people with the hand. You never know.
I saw someone say, "Is where's his right shoulder pad?" Mm. Like in the image you see there, it's like you can't see his right shoulder.
I reckon he might be like the Judiciar and not have a full right shoulder pauldron.
Yeah, actually. Could be right. Yeah,
because the Judiciar has just the little pad that shoulder pauldrons are meant to go on mm-hmm. his right shoulder as well. So that might be a mark of office thing. Who knows? Something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
We have Eradicators, which are aggressors, but losing the power fist to carry a long range melter rifle.
Long range melter. What a lovely combination of words.
Yeah. And hey, these guys are going to be tough. They're Gravis armor, so they're going to be like toughness 5, 3 wounds. They're toting around a bunch of melter weaponry that is apparently super long range. I'm going to call it now. I'm going to say it's a 36-inch range melter weapon.
I agree. Yep.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
So you can get that that melter bonus at a somewhat reasonable range with them. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. They're super awesome. The Assault Intercessor Squad we've seen before, but now we see the full squad of 10 as their little duplicates. Because they're all little duplicates, you could technically make 2 squads of 5 out of these, I'm pretty sure. Yes. Because the sergeant can be built as a regular one, so you could just build 2 sergeants. They're cool. I love their poses. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say on that. The Outriders, Primaris on bikes, look great. Love them. Been there, done that. So, let's move over to the Necron side of things,
mm-hmm.
where we get the buffest Overlord. he's been working out. he's got big, broad shoulders.
He's had plenty of time.
He's got a new weapon, which is a hyperphase glaive, and... according to my sources in the Necron communities, I think this is the first time a tachyon arrow has ever actually been modeled. I think before it was just an item that no one knew exactly what it's meant to look like on a model.
Right, yeah.
So that's that cool little wrist shooter thing he's got. He looks great. What else can I say? Moving on. Who cares about him, though? The actual best model on the Necron side is the Royal Warden.
Yeah.
Something about that guy... I think it's because the Royal Warden is like, it's a lieutenant immortal, basically.
Yeah,
he's an
immortal that's right.
Up through the ranks. He's basically, we're going to get to this, he's basically Vargard Obiron, but for any Necron Lord, let's be honest. But something about his pose and his design is that perfect mix of old and clean and disciplined and heroic mm-hmm. that I've been looking at this for 5 hours. It's beautiful.
it really is.
Insert image here. It's so cool. I love it. I'm sure it'll be somewhat good.
Yeah.
we have the Plasmancer, and then we start getting into the creepy stuff for Necrons. So this is the little floaty space pope guy who we saw in the big wide shot of all the new Necron stuff, and no one was sure who he is. He is a cryptic. Subclass kind of thing, who is so well versed in Necron hyper technology that everyone else seems to think he's a wizard. If you're not a Necron, you go, that's magic. Yeah. That's not technology, that's literally just magic.
Yeah.
He has a plasmic lance and a really, really creepy face that the eye seems to follow you.
Mm.
Just the one eye. He's got like the long pharaoh style chin. Which is
pretty. he looks really confident as well. He's got that sort of confident, aged sort of look. Like, I know what I'm doing here. I know when I'm needed. Yeah, he's a good lad. No feet as well.
no feet. And accompanying him are the Crypto Thralls, otherwise known as Murder Buckets, apparently. these are the things people thought might be a rework of Flayed Ones. They are not. They are like Cryptek bodyguards, basically. Apparently they're pretty good in close combat as long as they're protecting a character. So they look interesting. They look really different from everything else that Necrons have, but they share some basic design stuff, so we'll see how they go, I guess. Scorpec Lord, love him. Seen him.
Yeah.
He's so cool. Scorpec Destroyers, love them, seen them. The Plasmacyte, which we've seen in leaks, is this quote-unquote innocuous machine that just drifts behind the Destroyers and seems to juice them up with tainted energy, apparently.
Yeah.
It's this cute little thing, and they're calling it innocuous right now. I'm going to call that this has the character rules because it's just a little orb that follows the Necrons around and no one thinks it does anything. But who knows? Who cares about that? We're going full War of the Worlds. The Canoptech Reanimator. This is the less aggressive looking big quadruped walker thing because it doesn't... It's less aggressive because it doesn't have a Doomsday Cannon strapped to the top. It still looks pretty mean. This thing is so weird. It's so cool. I want to get a second one just to steal it for my Dark Mechanicus to make a Malanthrope equivalent. Mm. They're really getting somewhere with the long spindly leg things on Necron machines, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, and it has atomizer beams, so that'll be fun. then we have new Scarabs, who are super cute. Love the little guys. Aren't they just the best? again, getting good at giving odd descriptions Warhammer community because they are now described as murder bugs, the size of dustbin lids.
I'm seeing a theme here.
And then the Necron Warriors, who look great. And apparently, in the kit, there's a choice of different heads for each one, so you can choose how damaged their head looks. And there is a choice of which weapon they have, so you can give them all Gauss Blasters, or you can give them all Gauss Reapers.
Yep, sorry.
For a push-fit kit, that kind of option is actually really, really good.
Very good,
super handy. So that's all the 61 models in there. Oh, I would be remiss to not mention one of the Necron Warriors has a tiny, eeny baby scarab just peeking out from behind his ankle. It is the cutest goddamn thing ever. I love it.
Go get him.
And the other big important thing is the Warhammer 40,000 core book. Again, they're not saying 9th edition anywhere. They're still not saying 9th edition anywhere.
No, they're not.
Warhammer 40,000 core book. But this is an exclusive alternate cover, which is that art of Gilliman as the descending angel and Abaddon as the red evil demon, basically. This book looks so fucking slick.
It really does.
I love that. It's so pretty. It's absolutely awesome. So this has all the rules for the game, obviously. So all the different game sizes, all the rules for Crusade and all that, all the new rules, all the cool stuff. It is 370 odd pages, apparently. And it's a big book. Full of lore and art. I'm so looking forward to reading this for the art because they did an article showing off some of the art a week or two ago, I believe.
Yep.
And it was so cool. And the final thing in the box, the final important thing in the box, is another smaller book called Edge of Silence, which has all the stats for all the new Primaris and Necron stuff. As well as revealing the harrowing nature of the Pariah Nexus and the stage set for a crucial new war zone as the magnitude of the Necrons as a threat is unveiled. So it actually kind of sounds like Edge of Silence might be the culmination of some of the Psychic Awakening Pariah stuff specifically, we'll see, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole whack of transfers for the Space Marines, none for the Necrons, of course, and the Assembly Guide, which, looking at the front of the Assembly Guide, shows off just how much goddamn stuff is in
I know. Box. It's a lot of plastic.
It's a lot of plastic. It's a bit absurd, honestly.
Hmm.
And Games Workshop is saying it saves you over 50% compared to getting the content separately, which, hey, means the contents are coming out separately
at Yay. Some point.
Hooray. It's super cool. I'm hopping on board this train, even if I leave most of it just sitting in a box for a few months. But
yeah, that's fine.
That's fine. Whatever. But
that's how this hobby works.
Yeah. Part of me really wants to do, like, a Necron army speed paint and challenge myself to see if I can do all the Necrons over a weekend.
Yeah.
That might be fun. Because, again, if I do them, I'm going to do traditional Necrons, I think, just for ease of use. Do them silver, spray them lead belcher, tidy them up with some nice dry brushing stuff. But I would like to paint an army in a weekend, and I think these guys would look nice in that. Yeah.
I mean that's the good thing with this set as well, is that both sides you're getting proper units as well. You know, I know in theory Dark Imperium, I think you did everything was you know, a normal unit, whereas obviously we saw, like, with Soul Wars in AOS where you didn't get full, you know, proper units, you know, in that sense. Whereas, so it's nice that, you know, you're getting 10 intercessors, you're getting 20, you know, Necron warriors. That's really good. That's solid numbers to have as well. So you can definitely see where it's definitely aimed at sort of the more veteran player that, like I said, already has a collection. They just, like, want to get, you know, some new Marines, or, you know, maybe start Necrons, and, you know, you've already got a really good sort of start, or, you know, a good addition to what you already have. So that's really exciting. I'm like I said, this box, I cannot fault as a box. I think everything in it looks absolutely gorgeous, both Primaris and both Necron. You know, the book is great. And like I said, if it ends up being the £120 price point, which, you know, I'm sort of very certain it's going to be, that's really good for what you get in there. For I think it's going to, it's really, really solid. So, yeah, I'm definitely 100% going to get it. I think my only decision, which will depend on other people, is whether I get, well, I'll definitely get a box. It's whether I'm sort of what I'm hoping to do with my mate Martin is hopefully potentially he gets a box and we swap, you know, halves. So we double up on stuff. He takes all the Necron stuff. I take all the Primaris stuff, and that's double the goodness. My only thoughts is, on a personal level, is how I'm going to walk, you know, because obviously this will be stuff I'll be aiming towards my Space Wolves. It's like, this is going to be a bit of a challenge wolfing a lot of these up, but that's cool. That's part of the fun.
Yeah. The Assault Intercessors and Eradicators, I think, will go fine.
Oh, yeah, that'll be easy. It's more the Blade Guards.
The veteran stuff is, going to be the harder stuff.
Yeah, that's fine.
Although, stick a sweet-ass wolf helmet on that Judicia, and I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Put a little fur trim on that leather coat, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You'll be fine. These are so good.
No. I know. One thing I was going to say actually about the Necrons as well is that I like the way they're sort of looking at now, in the sense that they're feeling very, I was saying this to the guys, very Skynet at a Terminator now. Like, not just as in the different units are not all humanoid, for example. They're sort of, you know, you've got a lot of things that are weird little, you know, little robot type things that sort of interact. And it's like you see when you know, if you watch your Terminator movies and you see the, where they go to the future, and you know, you got all these different units that all interact with each other and they're not all humanoid. I love that. And I think they're definitely sort of, you know, picking up on that vibe, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So with that, I mentioned they've been doing a bunch of other streams. So they have been doing, I'm going to call here, this has been Games Workshop's best show of actually drip-feeding information to the community properly. A lot of the times they're like, oh, this month's going to be like the full information leading up to this release month, and we get an article that says nothing, and an article that says half of nothing, and then right at the end they say this, right before you actually pre-order it. They have been really consistent. They've been doing streams, not every night, but I think every couple of nights for the last week or two, detailing how 9th edition is going to work. So there's things like there are now set minimum table sizes, depending on the size of the game, which are slightly smaller than the average table size used in 8th edition, which people have been trying out. And apparently it's not too bad for melee armies because there's less room to run around effectively, even if it's a little less room, which is nice. Command points, attachments, and missions all sort of interact with each other at this point. So depending on the size of the game, You can take up to a certain number of detachments. Set rule. Not a suggested thing that's a tournament rule that is widely adopted. It is the rules. You know, at 2,000 points, you can take 3 detachments. That's it.
Yep.
Honestly, probably for the best, because detachments also cost you command points, unless your warlord is in the detachment, at which point your warlord refunds some or all of those command points.
Yeah.
So, like, for example, a battalion costs 3 command points to bring, but if your warlord is in the battalion, he gives you 3 command points back. Mm-hmm. So it balances out. And people are thinking maybe other detachments won't be quite as generous. So, like, say, a supreme command detachment might cost you 2 command points, but if your warlord's there, you might only get 1 back or something.
I think
you're loading up on the good stuff, basically.
I think from memory, the warlord has to be in, to get the refund, has to be either a battalion, a brigade, or something else. I think there's only three detachments they can be part of to get that refund back, I believe.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah.
So you can't just chuck them into like a vanguard or something to get it back. I'm pretty sure that's what I read somewhere.
Yeah. They've been talking a bit about Crusade. I'll be honest, I did not hear a lot about what they've been saying about Crusade, but I'm still so excited for Crusade.
Oh, I can't wait. Can't wait.
The basics of it are, as you do more games, your units gain experience and level up and get cool new abilities and things like that. And you can fully interact Crusade, which is narrative play, with match play, because if your Crusade army is of a higher level than an opponent's Crusade level is, basically, they get bonus command points each at the start of the game to make up for that difference in technical power. Like, your power level isn't actually higher, but your units might have some slight buffs from being veterans rather than just being completely green troops straight out of the codex.
Yeah, exactly. That's the I love that idea. I love the fact that you can, you know, you can just rock up at a club, you know, you could be, you know, you could be playing with your mates and, you know, your Crusade forces at one level, you play with someone that you've never played with before, there is at a completely different level, yet they still try and find a way to sort of do that, really. And I like the fact that with Crusade, it's again similar to Warcry, where it's you do it off your own back. You can go out and just fight. So you're not sort of, you know, if say you and your play group who, I don't know, play in the garage, you know, you can do that. But if you, one of you just wants to rock up and play with some other people at your local club, you can, you know, sort of, it doesn't impact, you know, your mates at home, basically, which I think is a really good. And actually, sorry, just going back to the point about the command points. Yeah, I was right. I just quickly saw it. For the warlord to get the refund, it's a patrol battalion or brigade. To get the refund.
Interesting. And for Crusade, I personally like that if you interact with a matched play player with your Crusade army, there is a distinct benefit that they get from still playing with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I imagine in 8th, I would have loved to make a custom character with the chapter approved, like make your own custom character rules. But then, if I went to play, we'd be playing match play, and I'd plonk my guy down, like, this is my Death Guard Lord, he's got all these cool buffs. And they go, oh, that doesn't seem very fair. And I go, yeah. Whereas in this one, it's like, here's my Death Guard Lord, he's got all these cool buffs from the Crusade he's been on. Also, you get 3 more command points. And the other guy goes, yeah, 3 more command points. Hell yeah, yes, chuck them in.
Well, that's what match play players like. Hey, num, 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 num. Give me all those command points.
A lot of, I believe it's on a mission by mission basis, but a lot of missions give you a command point back a turn, I believe, which is nice.
Yes.
So you never truly run out of them. You can always do at least something.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Blast weapons, I'm super happy about. So if they target a unit of 6 to 10 models, they always count as rolling a 3 on their random number of shots for blast weapons.
Yep.
If it's 11 or more models, they always count as rolling the maximum number of shots.
Yep.
So that's really cool. It makes them feel super effective, and I feel the unit sizes are about right. It makes Space Marine tactical squads really good because they have the combat squad ability. So you buy a unit of 10, load them up, and then split them into 5s to avoid blast weapons.
Mm-hmm.
All that kind of cool stuff. They haven't clarified 100% how it works with, like, D3 blast weapons and multiple dice worths of blast weapons and stuff, but I think it'll probably just be, if it's 6 to 10, you roll a 3 on a D3, that means you get your max amount. because you can only roll a 3 on a D3, and on 11 plus, you get your max amount, and I think that'll be per dice. So, like, exorcists are going to be fun, for example. Terrain is getting a big overhaul from being more or less non-existent, which is really cool. There's a whole bunch of terrain traits. Part of setting up the game is determining with your opponent what traits different pieces of terrain have. They can give you bonuses to cover against range attacks. They can give you bonuses to cover against melee attacks. They can slow you down, or you can hide more efficiently in them. And there is, in particular, obscuring, where if a piece of terrain is of a particular height or more, you literally can't shoot through it no matter what. Even if there's a tiny little window that you can see with your sniper eye, the very end of an opponent's bolt gun, you can't shoot him. It's an obscuring piece of terrain.
I love that. I think that's of everything I've seen rules wise so far, I think that is one of the things I'm most happy about, because I must admit, as someone you know, that obviously don't really get a chance to play but watches more than anything, that's the thing I've always found frustrating with previous edition, the fact that, like I said, you could see, you know, the sail of some Drukhari, you know, thing going on, and it's like, no, that's not a justifiable reason to be able to take that unit out. No, that makes so much more sense.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, there are a couple of weird case points there, because obscuring terrain doesn't obscure any model with 18 or more wounds, which, interestingly enough, means the Triumph of St. Catherine can't hide behind obscuring terrain, despite the fact that they're all human height behind a 5-inch tall piece of terrain.
Yeah.
I feel that would have been easier to address with a keyword, because, like, the implication is clearly for, like, titanic units, like knights and other big stuff, to not be able to hide behind it. So if you'd said, like, titanic or monster models with the wounds of 18 or over, I think would have been nicer, because at the moment, those poor sisters of battle are somehow big and scary enough to be shot through a completely solid concrete wall.
Yeah.
Somehow. And then flyers, they're being cool. They're flying around while they're doing bombing runs. They can fly off the table, then back on the table. They're getting rid of situations where, for some reason, they would randomly crash if enough people were clustered underneath them. all kinds of things like that. Mm-hmm. And of course, people can cluster underneath them properly, because the flyer isn't there on the ground. So now they're making it clear that you can walk over the flyer's base, because it's not there.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah.
Makes perfect sense. War of the Spider is up for pre-order. Oh, I'm excited for this one. I'm excited for this one. So I'll do a quick thing on Death Guard first. Death Guard are getting 28 new stratagems, 7 of which are locked to certain Vectorums. Each Vectorum is, or play company rather, is getting its own Warlord trait, stratagem, and relic. There are also 6 generic relics coming through. What we've seen is so cool, super cool so far. In particular, there's a stratagem to add 6 inches to the range of any plague-ranged weapons you're equipped with, which is a grenade for a Death Guard. Their black grenade, their frag grenade equivalent, can have 12-inch range. If you've got 20 plague marines targeting a unit of 11 or more mortals, they throw 120 shots at 12 inches. You stick the grenade character behind them. Those shots are strength 4, damage 2, mortal wounds on 6s to wound. 120 shots. Rerolling everything to wound, because why not? like, there's going to be some fun shenanigans between the new blast rules and these Death Guard stratagems. I'm really looking forward to playing around with it. Also, we're going to have more command points in 9th, so I will be able to play around with these, which is really nice. But who cares about the Death Guard? The Imperium are getting some cool things. Sisters of Silence won't break a Custodes detachment, which is nice.
Yep.
Custodes are getting a whole bunch of cool stuff, like being able to buff your shield captain into a shield commander and giving him stuff like 2 more wounds or 2 more attacks if he's fighting more than 6 guys. He basically becomes a blast weapon against hordes and melee, which is hilarious. all kinds of good stuff. The Imperial Assassins are getting what I think is the coolest, trickiest stratagem, which is if you have the Assassin in your list, like you're not coming in via stratagem, which they can already do, you can use a stratagem to switch it to a different Assassin immediately at the start of the game, which is hilarious. And they are getting, this is becoming more prevalent, I think there's a 1 or 2 in Engine War, actually, they are getting a zero command point stratagem, which mm-hmm. I like that these exist. They should exist more.
Definitely.
Yeah. Because if an assassin takes out a character, you pay zero command points and gain one command point or two if it was a warlord, because they're neutralizing priority threat. That's super cool.
Yeah.
I think stratagems where they are super specific like that and super, super fluffy should be zero, like for those like little minor things where they're doing exactly what they are built to do.
Yeah, that should be the reward, shouldn't it? Mm. At the end of the day, you're getting rewarded with command points rather than have to pay command points to then get potential, you know, refund on it. No, have a proper, you know, reward where they you actually, you know, in theory, if you pull this off, which like I said, is a very specific situation that, you get something which isn't game breaking. You know, you're getting one to two extra points, which is cool. You know, that's a lovely thing to have, but it's not sort of turning things on its head either.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And then we get to the real meat of this one, which is Fabius Bile's Creations of Bile. We all thought it was going to be Agents of Bile, but they've changed the name apparently.
Yeah.
These are the Creations of Bile. This is a Renegade Legion. Their universal trait is they get plus one movement and plus one strength. This is going to be nuts. So I wrote up a little mini list of this focused around Possessed.
Nice.
With Fabius Bile working on them, you can get a unit of Possessed running 8 inches every turn. They are strength 7. They've got extra attacks. On a charge, they'd be doing 2 plus D3 attacks each or something like that. If you set it up properly, you can have a Master of Possession there to give them bonuses to their invulnerable saves. And suddenly, this seems like... I mean, it was already an incredibly cool idea for an army, like Fabius Bile leading a bunch of Twisted Marines. But this is really, really cool. They're getting cool stratagems, cool relics. They are a fully fledged out sub-faction, which I love.
Yep.
I'm really hoping there's a new men stratagem to really buff up a unit of cultists, because there's still a bunch of stuff excluding cultists, which is like the new wording of how things work in a lot of chaos stratagems, because Games Workshop remembers the 40 cultists.
yeah, true.
But this is so cool.
Mm.
I'm so excited. In 9th edition, I think I'm going to do a bunch of like 1,000 point armies.
Yeah.
I want to do Primaris Marines. I want to do Necrons. I want to do Fabius Bile. I'm getting some Harlequins from a friend because he's moving. I want to do Harlequins.
but that's a good thing though, because like I said, now the way this new edition working, that I can see there being a lot more people that want to play at those sort of points levels. I must admit that's whenever I start a new project, I always 1,000 points is my. In my head, I don't even think about 2,000 points, because there's a good chance I'm probably never going to get to it, potentially, because either I'll want to do something else, or it's just, you know, just too much, or not where I want it to be. Whereas with Crusade, with these sort of, or even if you don't do Crusade, even just the fact that they're sort of doing missions for 500 points, for 1,000 points, I'm hoping that putting aside, you know, a lot of the tournament play, I'm just hoping that will sort of, I don't know, make people sort of think about it a bit more, go, yeah, you know what, 1,000 points. Yeah, let's do it. Let's rock it up. And, you know, we've got missions.
Yeah.
It's no different to playing a 2,000 points. You're just more limited. But then you'll get it done quicker. And again, it means that, you know, obviously what I'm about to say is very obvious, but rather than focusing on one 2,000 point army, have two 1,000 point armies of two completely different factions. Then you get variety, and you know, and it just keeps those ideas ticking over. I think it's the best of both worlds, really.
Absolutely. So yeah, 9th edition is super exciting, not only for all the stuff we described previously, but also because it brings us the dumbest looking model I've ever seen.
Whatever do you mean?
So at the end of the stream, some people missed it because they paused the stream because, like, oh, they're wrapping up the stream, apparently.
That being me.
Not calling anyone out. Yeah. They showed off some more models coming to both Primaris Marines and Necrons, and they led with the Invader ATV. That's all-terrain vehicle for those not in the know, which is a buggy with no suspension and a Primaris Marine driver with a Gatling cannon directly next to his left ear, where I'm sure even with all of his helmet technology and his special Space Marine ears, he will be deaf forever. This is basically the Primaris take on the attack bike, because it can take an Onslaught Gatling Cannon or a Multi-Melter.
Yep.
I think the idea is great,
but
I didn't see an actual image of this until I dug through 50 posts on the Reddit, on the Warhammer 40k Reddit, which were all pictures of this as a Mario Kart machine. Yeah.
I've seen it as everything. It is the new meme already. I feel sorry for the other releases that were part of this. Not just obviously the what's going to be in the new box, but also the other things that we're about to cover. Like you said, the things that they showed off right at the end. It's such a shame that all these other cool stuff that the only thing that's getting attention at the moment is this bloody ATV because of how horrendous it looks.
Now, I will be fair, this is a terrible Space Marine model, but this is a perfect Orc model.
Yes.
This is literally, someone did a side-by-side, this is literally the old Orc war buggy, but Primaris Marine.
Yeah.
Like, the guy with the big rapid-fire gun standing directly behind the driver, who is surely deaf, in this little squat machine, it's a thing. It's something.
The thing is, it's one of those where, like you said, the idea behind it is great. I mean, like I said, they've just updated the attack bike, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's execution that I think has let this one down. Mm. It just doesn't look right. And again, it's sort of how I felt with the Repulsor and the Repulsor Executioner particularly, where, again, you see the point behind it. It's like, this is a big fucking tank with lots of guns, you know, and that's the way it should be. But again, it looked to me, the model just doesn't reflect what I think they had hoped. And again, it's the same with this one. It just looks very flat. It doesn't really have much personality. It just doesn't look, I think in simple terms, it just doesn't look cool. Like this is sort of units that should look cool. You should look at it and go, damn, that looks cool. Awesome. Yeah. The way you look at that, this just looks goofy and a bit shit.
I'm going to call this right now. This is going to have incredible rules. Everyone is going to want three in their army.
Yeah, probably.
And we are going to see everyone on Twitter desperately trying to build something that looks vaguely like this, but good.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. I think you've got a lot that you could work with this. Like I said, and I've seen people Photoshop, you know, putting aside the memes, putting aside the Mario Kart, I've seen people Photoshop what they think it should look like just based on what and there's some really good, just a few simple changes would make this a lot better. Like I said, it's not the premise behind it. It's just the way, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see when we see it from other angles as well. Maybe, to be fair, it could be having what I call the techless effect, where you look at it from one angle, it looks awful. You look at it from another angle, it doesn't actually look as bad as you first thought. And I think this maybe, you know, being positive, trying to be positive here, maybe when we see it from other angles, it may not look as bad as it does.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how to fix it, and how to fix it is simply to build the chassis down a little bit so it has some form of suspension, like place the wheels lower and put the actual main body of it up higher.
Higher, yeah.
So it has some kind of suspension, because at the moment, it looks like the driver's legs go lower than the bottom of the wheels.
It's a Flintstones car. That's how he's doing it.
Yeah, he's running along in those full power armor legs.
Using that superhuman legs to do it.
Oh my god. So yeah, that is what it is. It looks more like a puma than a warthog, if you ask me, but sure.
Yeah.
The other Primaris thing we got shown was the Firestrike Servo Turret.
Mm.
I have a couple of questions.
Mm.
Why is it called a Servo Turret if it's manned by a Tech Marine?
Is my first
question.
Yeah, good point.
And my second question is, why are they committing an entire Tech Marine to a single auto gun turret?
Yeah, I know. It seems like this could be automated. You know, it just doesn't need to be, like I said, with an actual servitor. Mm. It's a bit miss. I think it's really cool. Don't get me wrong. I think this absolutely is awesome. I think what I like about this is it is no frills. It's sort of just like, it's a big turret with big guns, a big shield, And it's nice to actually see, finally, a Primaris Tech Marine, because obviously, apart from putting aside the Forge Father as part of the Iron Hands, we don't actually have Primaris Tech Marines. And I'm hoping that's actually will become a thing. They will actually now release a standalone, because we've got all the other characters or choices. So, yeah, I like it. But yeah, I agree. The naming is a bit weird.
I also really like it. I think it would look so good if it was, like, mounted on some kind of vehicle instead.
Like a knight?
Like a knight. But someone did point out something interesting. It's called a Firestrike servo turret. And the little legs of the turret appear to have grav plates on the ends. Which implies this may be a deep striking from orbit fire platform.
I think you're right. Which would be hilarious. Yeah, that would be cool. Again, it makes sense. It goes with the whole, like, the suppressors, you know, the other Primaris unit are similar to that. So, yeah, I think I can totally see that. They'll just literally just drop these in, and that would be hilarious.
That would be so good. And I'm assuming they'll get different weapon options, because, like, of course they will. So, like, imagine dropping one of these in and it has, like, a heavy flamer or something. That would be cool.
Well, it already mentions that they're either twin accelerator autocannon or twin last talon. So, there's definitely two loadouts, but you're right, they may do more.
We'll see. Then we move to the two Necron things that were shown off. Now, we have technically seen these before in the big wide Necron shot, but we get close shots, which is nice. First off, we have the Locust Heavy Destroyer. That's Locust with a KH, not a C. Because, of course, this is just Jess Goodwin's original Heavy Destroyer sketch, made flesh, or metal in this case. It's beautiful. I love it. It is an extremely thick
boy.
C's destroyer. Like, just the level of girth on the turbines holding this thing aloft is beautiful. It's got the biggest Gauss gun that exists. It's awesome. It is like a super classic destroyer just updated into new Necron aesthetic, basically.
Definitely.
It's so much better than the actual heavy destroyers we currently have.
Yeah, definitely.
And the other one is the Canoptech Doomstalker, which is the Canoptech Reanimator, but a bit taller with a Doomsday Cannon strapped to the top. It's so cool. It looks fierce. It's got like two little point defense Gauss blasters on the front as well. But this thing's job is to walk around and annihilate stuff with a big gun. And it's so cool.
Definitely.
All right. That's all the new models we saw. But we're not done with the news yet, because there's still more to talk about. So, we are getting a novel written by the one, the only, say it for me, Matthew.
Mr. Gavthorpe.
Yeah, he's coming in with a novel called Indomitus, detailing what happens concerning the launch set, the Indomitus launch set. These new Primaris veterans and these Necrons are rising as a threat in the galaxy.
Yeah.
The reason this one's really exciting is it's a choose your own cover adventure.
Yes.
The limited edition has a Primaris Ultramarines cover or a Necron cover, both beautiful colored leather. and I don't know which one I would want to get. I want to get one for sure, but I don't know which one.
Did you notice with the marine one? If you look at it, it looks like he's giving you a middle finger. That's what I can't unsee that now.
Oh god, maybe I should get that one then.
Yeah, it was actually a shoulder guard, but no, I can't wait for this novel. Love Gavthorpe, what he writes, and we're 100% going to cover this book on the show.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You are warned.
This is the ninth edition novel. We got it.
Yeah. This is Dark Imperium, novel wise.
Yeah. That's it for the 40K news. It only took nigh on 50 minutes, so we'll steamroll through everything else.
Yeah.
Nothing for Age of Sigmar. You wanted to know about the Sons of Bayomet or the Luminarchs, the Lumineth Realm Lords? No. You'll find out when you're goddamn ready. Apparently.
When 40K's out of the way.
It's 40K's time to shine. Polish the 40K. The sweet 40K is our flagship. So in other news, the Warhammer crime novels are coming. The first one looks like it'll be really interesting. It was announced at a somewhat inopportune time with how the rest of the world is going. that's corporate marketing for you. It'll happen. I'm looking forward to reading it as an escape from the terrible police brutality of brutality of our real world. We can think about our fake police brutality in 40K, where it's good because it's a satire of how terrible those systems are.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as well is that it'll be, it's like they did with horror. It will, it's nice to see an alternative theme to a collection of novels. It's not, I like the fact they're expanding into, you know, other things. I know obviously with the current back catalogue of novels, there will be crime related stories. There was already horror sort of novels before officially, but it's nice that they're sort of focusing them. Because again, it gives the writers, you know, especially like, for example, obviously Chris Raitt is going to be doing Bloodlines, and he's one of the better authors as well. Is that it just gives them something else to focus on, and like, just, you know, because again, you know, there's nothing wrong with churning out the same sort of novels because obviously we all like it, but it's nice when they do something different. And I must admit, Warhammer Crime was not something I was expecting, and I'm really looking forward to it. I must admit.
Yeah, absolutely. There's another podcast coming. It's the Warhammer Community Podcast. They haven't paid us to say this, but they should have because we're advertising a competition. So they're out now. You can listen to them where you listen to podcasts. I believe their first episode is an interview with Adam Troke about various bits and bobs. I haven't actually listened to it yet. I'm getting there. But honestly, I've enjoyed listening to Voxcast and Stormcast over the year. So I'm sure this one will be good too. Aeronautica Imperialis, Skies of Fire is now available. Go get your tiny planes. Go get your tiny, incredibly cool planes that do cool strafe and maneuvers and dogfights. That's all I can say about that. The Tower Inn. So we're definitely out of the Horus Heresy era stuff for tiny miniatures, which is cool. And finally, this was the most tragic Games Workshop victim of Games Workshop closing down for 2 months, which was the day before you could order a Zote. You could no longer order a Zote. No. You can now order a Zote.
Yay!
Yay!
Zotes for everyone.
Zotes for all. So the Zote for Blackstone Fortress is up for pre-order. You can also include him in your 40k army, as he's unaligned and so will fit in with any faction just fine. I'm looking forward to seeing Tyranid armies with a Zote leading the way as the diplomat. Yes. That would be hilarious.
Yes. Awesome.
Yeah, with that, we've finally come to the end of all this goddamn news.
That's the way it's going to be for a while, obviously, regarding 40K, obviously, until the new edition is officially out. And let's be honest, even straight after that, they're going to be bombarding us with new stuff. So, you know, apologies to AOS fans, but, you know, that's, I suppose, the way things are going at the moment. And, you know, at least, I suppose, with AOS, at least we know what is on the horizon, you know. The great thing is, it's not, you know, that two brand new factions are on the way, you know, within the, you know, very soon, you know, when that is, we don't know exactly, but we know they're on the way. So, and to be fair, I suppose, I think it sort of makes sense. Obviously, like you said, 40K is their flagship game, so they're going to put a lot more effort in, you know, like make sure that this takes, you know, precedent over the other bits, which, you know, makes sense really from a business perspective. But also I think as well is that it's nice to see new 40K stuff as well, because let's be honest, with AOS most stuff is new, whereas 40K you know, it's just been updates to books and the odd new model, whereas we're now getting a flood of new 40K stuff, and that's cool as well. But don't worry, AOS, it's your turn very soon.
Absolutely. Actually, now that I think about it, like the big last range expansion for 40K was probably the Chaos Marines at the sort of start-ish of last year.
Yeah. Wow. Exactly. That's what,
like,
I mean.
We've had a squad here and a squad there. Apart from that, but it was the first big range thing. Mm. And now we're getting all these Necrons, we're getting all these Primaris Marines. I'm holding out for a brand new faction in 9th.
Yeah. I think it needs to be done. I mean, let's be honest, 40K is not lacking in factions, but there's nothing better than a brand new faction, which obviously, I suppose, if you're into AOS, that's something you're really benefiting from, you know, where we've, you know, seen obviously like the Bone Reapers, the Deepkin, You know, obviously we've got the Realm Lords and the Sons of Bayomat on the way. So it's nice if you're AOS because you're getting literally brand new factions. And let's be honest, we all get hyped about new factions. So that's been the news. We finally got there. And then I think it's now time to have our next little break. And when we return, hopefully we don't get severed. But we'll be talking about Severed. Back soon. Ho-ho, we're back. And we're back to talk about one of the best novellas ever. Well, in my opinion, anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes, as said earlier, we're going to be discussing, that's a new word, discussing Severed by Nate Crowley. So this is part of Novella Series 2 that came out a while ago, which I still need to buy the rest of them for. It's really odd. I got the first one straight away, the first whole set, and then for the sort of second group of 10, I've only got like three of them. I must buy the rest of them. Remind me, Cameron. Yeah. I must buy them.
I will remind you.
So we thought, as we're on the 9th edition Necron hype train, let's talk a book about Necrons. Because why not? Because actually, there's not that many out there in general.
No.
So it was nice to sort of pick this one. And luckily, it's bloody good. So,
it's so good.
it's really, really good. So I know, obviously, we're going to go through it, but buy it. Buy it now. Why are you not buying it? Go out there right now.
Then read it, then listen to us.
Yes. It all makes sense.
Won't take too long. Yeah.
And obviously, as always, spoiler warning, because we're going to be talking spoilers. So, right, okay. I shall read the back of the book, because Cameron only has the ebook version, and they don't like having backs. Right. A near peerless tactician, Nemesaur Zandrex, battlefield acumen, has won countless wars for the Necrons of the Soltec dynasty. His dauntless shadow is Vargard Oberon, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Oberon, I think.
I think that's how you pronounce it. So both his tireless protector and eternal companion. When the ghosts of Zandrek's muddled past return to haunt him, their bond and Zandrek's already fragile sanity is put to the test. Forming an uneasy alliance with an old acquaintance, Nemesaur Setek, they head for Doat, a world which harbours both horror and hope in equal measure. What lurks in the darkness, and what purpose does Setek have above his service to the Soltec dynasty? So, yeah. That's be warned. There's lots of names that are very similar to each other in this.
Yeah.
So hence why I was struggling to read it, because they're very very similar, some of the names in this. So apologies if we get any of these the wrong way around, because it's easy to do. So obviously we've just been praising it. So Cameron, tell me what you think about it.
I think this is going to be in like the top three of the entire novella of both novella series books for me. It's up there with some of the much longer Black Library books, honestly. Like, it is relatively simple in its overall purview, like what it actually covers, but this book is a fantastic character study.
Yes.
Of two characters, which is fantastic. It's even better because one could say this is like a second person book almost, because we see everything from Vargard Oberon's perspective. But realistically, this book is just as much about Zandrek, his overlord, as it is about him. And I mean, a Necron would say it is absolutely about Zandrek and not about his humble bodyguard, but you know, there's Necrons for you. I knew nothing about these two until I read this book. I read this book and immediately tried to buy the bottles and was only stopped by the fact that the Games Workshop store was down for the day. it's that good. It's nothing crazy plot-wise.
No.
It's just the characters are so good. Mm-hmm. They are so fantastically well done. You get a good glimpse into how Necrons just are in the current day of 40K, and we get a glimpse into how they were at one point. Mm. Like, so the big hook here is Nemesaw Zandrek is stuck in the past. He doesn't realize what has happened to the entire species of the Necron tier.
Yep.
And so he thinks he's somehow become, he's living out these immortal halcyon days of campaigning across the Necron Empire, or the Necron tier empire rather. And, you know, he's flesh and blood, everyone around him is flesh and blood, and they're just having a, they're having a bloody good show. What for? Cheerio. He really is that sort of stereotypical British army officer kind of character, and it's definitely so good as a Necron. It's just like, what are the ballywags up to right now, say? it is a stereotype, but putting it onto a Necron and still giving it actual depth means it feels really, really good. Like, yep. he is hilarious to, I was going to say listen to, you're reading, unless you've got an audiobook version of this, which I don't believe exists.
No, it doesn't. But it does in your head.
when characters are done well enough to the point where you can hear them fully realize in your head, you know they're going somewhere with this.
Yeah.
It's so good. And of course, what makes it even better is we have this fantastic Necron overlord who doesn't realize he's a robot. He's living out his best days, and then his second-in-command, his tireless bodyguard, the Oberon to his Titania, or his Titanium, maybe. actually, that might be the joke. Titanium's technically the more masculine.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
I'll take that subtle reading into things too far. Unless, Nate Crowley, if you meant that, let me know so I feel smart. Vargard Oberon doesn't share in this insanity at all. He is completely aware of what's going on. He's lived through the past, you know, few thousand years and slept through the 65-ish million before that. Like, it is his job to keep Zandrek safe, and that's all he cares about. But he finds him so annoying.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And just the interplay between those two and Oberon's growth throughout the book as he struggles with himself is really what's fantastic, because this is a book about two characters. At the heart of it, it is a robot who was once a person asking, can I still love? Am I still worthy of love? Am I a person let anymore, really, or am I just what I am physically? And that is kind of crazily deep and philosophical for a goddamn Warhammer novella. And then it's just mixed in with, like, there's some cool battle stuff. There's tons of cool alien tech stuff going on and everything. It's just good.
Yeah. I think what made this one, well, I totally agree with everything you said then. And I think B, one of the things that why I love this one so much is it completely caught me off guard. I did not think this is what I would be reading. You know, in my head I was like, right, I bought this. It's a Necron novella. Yeah, Necrons being evil, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I just thought that's what it would be. And it would be, you know, a nice little feel-good romp for the whole family. But thinking, you know, back now, it's almost like you forget they're Necrons in this. Oh, that's how I read it sometimes. When you're hearing, you know, Zandrek talking, and like I said, in that proper British Army upper lip type of way, you forget he's literally a robot. He's in metal, and it doesn't come across like that until you other things get described to sort of almost remind you, go, oh yes, by the way, he is actually a Necron, it's, you know, and such. And I think, you know, the way to sort of summarize it, it feels like a, you know, like an elderly person, or in this case a Necron, suffering with dementia. And, you know, he's got his bodyguard. It almost feels like his carer. And that's why it feels at times quite emotional and quite sad. Because obviously Zandrek is in his own, you know, his own world, so to speak. And obviously with his bodyguard sort of going, oh, I wish, you know, like I said, he does stuff that irritates me, but I still will do anything for him. And that's what comes across multiple times through, you know, what's it, only, a, you know, just over 100 so pages. And like you said, the rest of the novella is all very good. Like, when it's not about them, when it's actually just the actual story, i.e. the, you know, the battles going on and things like that, again, all done very well, but that's just, again, just ticking things along. It's actually the relationship between these two Necrons, which, again, feels really weird saying that. I didn't think I'd be talking about Necron relationships, but that's sort of what you can't not do when you're talking about this book. And the one thing I love particularly about this is the human characteristics that come with this as well. You know, like I say, we see multiple times, especially in Xandrek's example, you know, which again, you don't associate with Necrons, or I don't, you know, going into this book, is he's coughing. He's talking about the weather. He's talking like, there's the moment where he's talking about the weather, which would literally burn us if we, you know, if we were there. It would literally destroy us. It would melt away. And he's like, oh, it's a bit warm, isn't it, today?
Yeah.
Put your sun cream on, lads.
I think it was like they were on a planet that was even more radiation blasted than the original Necron tier homeworld.
Exactly.
Like, a beautiful, balmy day. Everybody's
it's crazy. He's got, you know, on his flagship, he's got a kitchen. He's got Necron followers that would be the kitchen staff who are doing nothing because they've got, obviously they don't eat. He's pretending to eat and drink. You know, he's got a goblet that's filled with nothing. You know, he's pretending to drink from it. Again, it's not stuff to me anyway. You associate with Necrons. You do not think that that's how they operate. Again, he's very unique compared to all the other Necrons, but I think it's so enlightening and so great to see that, don't you think?
He is such an interesting look into what Necrons can be and what Necrons are in some cases, in his case in particular. Like, and one of my favorite things is just how everyone has to deal with him, because he's insane, but he's the most tactically gifted commander in the entire Saltek dynasty.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, he doesn't lose battles. He literally just does not. And even though he's insane, all these overlords that are under him are just all sitting at a table. They've all got their own goblets, just like crushing their grips out of frustration.
Yeah.
While Xandrek's toasting all of them, saying, well done, everyone. And it's like, ah! And then the best bit is, Every mission he's sent on is couched by Imhotep, who is the actual leader of the dynasty, as, you know, you've got to go deal, there's this trouble in the homelands, there's this dynasty over here is rebelling, they're stubborn, or they're worrying, or they're panicked, or whatever, so we just need you to go pacify things, bring the Empire back under control, because from Xandrek's point of view, he is mostly fighting Necron-tier rebels, but, you know, he's actually fighting orcs and Adeptus Mechanicus and all that kind of stuff. I believe, as I mentioned, when he was sent to fight Tyranids, he thought he was fighting, you know, a legion of very large dogs. Yeah.
Who kept getting bigger.
But the thing is, he's a proper gentleman. And so he captures people for ransom, and while holding them, they enjoy his hospitality. So at the start of the book, he's holding court with all his Necron overlords. And the planetary governor he captured is just sitting in a corner as a guest of honor, being told, you know, oh, I hope you're enjoying your fine, wonderful meal, as he just stares at a dusty plate.
And also the fact as well, because obviously from a language perspective, he doesn't know what they're saying, because obviously he doesn't understand Necron language either, or Necron tier language. So you can just imagine this really surreal experience. He's been, you know, he's been captured from his home world that's been, you know, been taken over by them. He's then sat down where, like I said, with a plate of nothing, where they're talking to him, like, where acting like they know what he said, or he knows what they're saying. And then obviously you've got these angry overlords around. And doesn't he end up like literally shitting himself, and then his heart gives way or something like that?
Yeah, because part of Oberon's job is to dispose of these hostages before they start messing up the place too much, because Xandrek, you know, forgets about them as soon as he leaves dinner.
Yeah.
So Oberon goes to strangle the governor to death, and he's like, oh, he had a heart attack. That makes things easier. Someone send him some scarabs and take him away.
Yeah. It's so surreal. It really is. But I love it. It was one of those books where I felt like every paragraph or every bit that was carrying on, I couldn't wait for what else was being described. It felt like, and I don't With a lot of novels, I don't often feel that way. You know, you're going through the paces, but it felt like I can't wait to hear the next little random thing that he gets up to or says or something. It's almost like he's just, which almost is how the relationship between Zandrek and Oberon is, in the sense that, because obviously Oberon does a lot of listening, because obviously Zandrek is sort of constantly, you know, giving speeches and coming up with tales from his youth that obviously Zandrek's like almost shutting down half the time, isn't he? Because obviously Necrons don't sleep, but he sort of puts himself into like standby mode just so he can get through it.
Yes. That is my favorite thing that I didn't know about Necrons, which is Oberon has control over what he calls chronosense, which he completely controls at will his perception of time. Yep. So if Zandrek is making a long speech to all the overlords, he can literally skip hours into seconds.
Yeah.
But if he's in combat, he can skip seconds into days of time to in which to think about what's going on and plan his next move.
Yeah.
And, you know, because even he's moving in slow-mo then, he can then speed it back up to normal for the actual strike, slow it down again, look at where he needs to go next, figure out how to deal with this guy best. And It's incredibly terrifying, because, to be fair, the first thing Oberon does in the book is completely body a Calidus assassin.
I was going to mention that. That is one of my favourite scenes. But I love it's the way it's done. So for context, they're on the flagship. He's taking over Necron warriors and scarabs to basically see through their eyes. You know, he's basically using them as cameras, basically surveillance cameras. And so this obviously he realizes because obviously, as you'd imagine on the flagship, is like it's completely silent, no one moves, literally. Well, I was gonna say move a muscle, but obviously moves a metallic muscle.
Server.
You know, so if there's a hair's worth of movement somewhere, obviously, he can pick up on it straight away, and obviously, it's his job as bodyguard as well. And I love the fact that, this Calidus assassin sneaking in, and obviously, he knows that it's there. And then there's this sort of great moment where he's obviously fighting with the Calidus assassin whilst he's still listening to Zantek's rambling, who doesn't realize he's an assassin, and also doesn't give him like orders halfway through the fight, like, oh yeah, and we're gonna launch a bombardment. So he's like, he's always like, he's toying with this Calidus assassin, like he's half-ass fighting so he can half fight and half listen to his master at the same time. It's great. And then he literally sort of stabs his blade into its leg and then literally like back slaps it. He like bitch slaps this Calidus assassin and like squashes its head. It's so brutal.
Yeah. And then that's where we get we get hints at Zandrek's true motivations and like his tactical brilliance here, because, you know, at that time, as Oberon's fighting the assassin, he's going, you know, if we had fully committed like every other overlord wanted us to, right after X thing in the battle right there, I might not have been able to notice this because all the warriors would have been preparing to get off the barge, et cetera, et cetera. Like, she could have snuck by. But Zandrek, for seemingly no reason other than he wanted to, decided to sit back and just enjoy watching the battle from afar. And because of that, I was able to take out this assassin. And he just looks at his boss, and the boss looks back and is like, lovely day for it, huh?
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love these interactions between them. It's almost comedic at times, you know, where you can imagine Oberon like shaking his head like, you know, it's done so well. It really is. But I must admit, I like actually the story, like putting aside their relationship, I actually enjoy like the purpose behind the novel, in the sense that obviously you get this third character, which is Setek, which is basically Zandrek's rival / brother, from, you know, in quote marks, from their time in military school when they were young, because that's basically what they are.
Their time in military school 65 million years ago.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, you know, and it's funny because it could be seen as a bit tropey, but it comes across really well. Obviously, Setek is, you know, the conniving, you know, the rival that's obviously, you know, previously, according to Oberon, obviously tried to assassinate Zandrek. I think when they were still Necron tier, that's what the impression I got. And obviously, you know, Zandrek, you know, doesn't really know anything about that. And obviously, they have their sort of, again, British Army banter between them, like, you know, and obviously I like the fact they banter with each other, and obviously Oberon knows what's going on, but you still get that like class divide as well. You can tell that obviously these are both nemesaurs, they're both, you know, lords, and obviously even though Oberon is still, you know, still very well respected for his position, he is still a warrior class. It's like, yes, on your way, sir, on your way. We, you know, while we talk about our stories from when we were younger, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I love that. Again, it feels so out of place in Necron sort of culture, but it works, I think, anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. And again, I'm always going to go on this with every book we read. I love learning more about culture. And I didn't realize Necrons had a literal, like, caste system going on until I read this book. Like, I know they did in the present day, where they're all robots and you literally can't rise above your class. Like, a warrior can't become an overlord because they're literally not built for it. But back when they were Necron tier, you had to be born into command as well. If you're just a soldier, you're a soldier until you died or retired. If you're born of noble birth, you can be anything you want, because you're part of literally the better class. I didn't realize they had that. And again, it feels sort of like it draws a bit on Egyptian-y roots, like literally talking about like the peasantry doing all the building work and stuff like that.
Yep.
But it's really nice to get these flashbacks to that time. And then one thing I really love about Oberon is he commands the Lich Guard for Zandrek. And they all look identical, but he knows all of them by name, even though none of them had their minds actually survive the transference. They became, like, literal soulless Necrons, comparatively. Because all the really high-tier commanding and important people, including Oberon and Zandrek, of course, keep their personalities. But if you're lower than that, you don't need that, so you didn't get it. But he remembers all of them. He remembers their wishes and how they were like during their time as the Lich Guard, but made of flesh, not metal. And my favorite one bit is there's one companion called Neb, who he refers to as Dear Neb. And I'm like, oh, were they in love? But also, like, Neb's only wish was to die fighting alongside Oberon. And right near the end of the book, he makes basically a suicidal charge and specifically orders Neb stay close to me, and Neb turns around and says yes, which is the only time he ever speaks.
It's like, he almost like he acknowledges what their situation is, because didn't, like, I don't know if it's Neb or one of the others, but like he knows memories about them, like Neb didn't like to oversalt his food or something, like, you know, something really random, and they're all in engrams, aren't they? They're all basically like memory cards,
chips.
in his technology, and he, like I said, he knows them. And actually, talking of memories, that's actually quite another thing that's quite interesting in this, is that talking about Oberon particularly, obviously we were talking about his chronosense, but he's also got this sort of super mode, can he, where he can basically push his limits on his sort of hardware, so to speak, to actually sort of go, you know, go create, well, sort of, yeah, sort of going super mode, super strength, super speed, etc. But obviously the downside of that is if he pushes his limits, he starts losing memories, like, because basically it starts killing off old, you know, subroutines and engrams in his thing. So, like, there's this, like, quite poetic, where, like, there's this scene where he's, like pushing himself, you know, he takes out this enemy, takes out that, and, like, at that moment, you know, he loses the memory of what it was to taste. He loses the name of his long lost father. You know, it's like in real time. It's really quite poetic. And again, you just wouldn't associate it, but it's so done so well.
Absolutely. Like, the climax of this book is so good just for that reason, because he's pushing himself and pushing himself and pushing himself, and he goes to do, like, the last thing he needs to do and realizes, if I do this, I will forget everything I remember about Zandrek. And, like, can I do that? And he reaches the decision of, that's okay, because I'll still know I owe my loyalty and love to him. and he will be able to retell me everything we ever did together, and I can learn it from him.
Yeah,
and then goes for it and loses everything and wakes up later and is like, that's Zandrek. I don't know who that is, but it's Zandrek.
Yeah.
Why am I here? What am I doing? It's like, you overdid it.
Yeah.
What are you up to?
Exactly. And it's almost like he'll get like a real time sort of backup, won't he? Because Zandrek likes to talk, he will literally bombard him with memories.
Eventually.
Exactly. It's so good. So good. Actually, let's talk about The Severed, hence the title of the novella, because that's quite crucial to this as well. So basically, the one thing which I didn't know, and whether this is knowledge or brand new to this novella, but basically they go to the planet of Doat and waken it up, basically, and they end up fighting, I suppose, basically ghoul zombie type Necrons. That is basically ends up being like it's Necrons versus Necrons. And so it basically comes from the sort of the situation where the usual plan for any tomb world out there in the 40K universe is that basically an autonomous spirit guards over the Necrons while they're in slumber. And then basically when it's time for that tomb world to wake up, the spirit guard will basically wake up all the workers, the guards, to basically start, you know, kicking things off for eventually when the overlords and other lords start to wake up. And then you've got this, you know, situation where sometimes the lord mind, you know, obviously degrades while they're in slumber. And then obviously what can happen is if the lord has no real sort of, like Cameron said earlier, where the menials have not got really any sort of memories or such, like, whereas the lords are the ones that run it. Obviously, if the lord loses his memory whilst in slumber, whilst on this tomb world, then effectively the world becomes leaderless. And then obviously the autonomous spirit has to take over the running of the planet, or this tomb world. And obviously the downside to that is that the spirit has only got so much experience, so much, you know, routines in its sort of banks. So it takes over command with this limited knowledge. And then in turn, it's great because it basically makes them it can make them hostile to other Necrons. They can even go on their own crusades. I thought, what a fantastic idea.
It's so cool. It is the creepiest thing I've read for a while in a 40K book, honestly, because we've just spent, you know, the first chunk of the book getting used to Necrons are people. They are they are people. They still are. Like, they still have thoughts and feelings and everything. And then we open the doors into this tomb world and you just see uncountable billions of zombie Necrons with red eyes. They've got red Gauss blasters. They move wrong. They just, they don't even march uniformly. They shamble because the autonomous spirit can't control them effectively all at once. It just gives them a basic directive and they do that to the best of their ability. They shamble. They're unthinking. And you didn't realize how big tomb worlds were until you get down into the core of it and you see off in the distance a red glow and you realize it is a billion Necrons climbing in a spiral up a ramp that leads 100 kilometers to the world's surface as reinforcements for the fight currently going on the surface. Yeah,
from the core as well.
From the core of the goddamn planet. it is incredible.
Crazy. Yeah. Like I said, and that's terrifying. The thing that sort of takes Oberon and the rest of the forces, because they're, you know, getting stuck in fighting them. And it's like the fact that, like, I love that moment. There's a moment later where Zandrek and Oberon sort of travel down into the core, which is really cool. And like you said, when they see that, these sort of, well, I suppose not transports, but like I said, all these billions of Necrons sort of being filtered up from the core up to the surface. And they sort of, there's that realization, like, we were never going to win this, no matter what. There's just the numbers, even though we're much more effective, because obviously they're shambling zombies Necrons, whereas we're sort of switched on Necrons. We're never going to win this. It's a battle of attrition. We're going to lose.
I think the quote was, we could lose one for every 1,000 they lost, and we would still lose the war of attrition millennia before the tomb world ran out of bodies.
Yeah.
Like, oh, God. Okay.
And like you said, that gives them some real perspective of these tomb worlds. And obviously, it also suggests that there's quite a few of them as well.
Like, again, the Necron Tier had a literal galaxy-spanning empire. So did the Eldar. but the Eldar didn't leave the entire Eldar population asleep across the galaxy. Like,
yeah, true.
Like, I've seen a lot online lately of people trying to do the maths on how many people live in the Imperium, and you have to remember, you have to take all that maths and apply it to Necrons, because every single one of those guys is still alive, technically speaking.
Yeah.
They're somewhere. They're just out there waiting.
Yeah. And again, I another thing as well that I liked was also this, again, going back to that sort of Skynet comparison, like where there's like command nodes where they like where the as the spirit learns, as it's adapting, it will start sort of taking certain Necrons and making them the command node, which in turn will influence the other severed Necrons around them. And so they obviously have to go on this sort of great task of trying to take down all these command nodes and things like that.
Yeah.
And I particularly like that sort of that battle that ends up being over a bridge or a ravine, there's Necron destroyers that, you know, get that the severed start bringing, because obviously again they're starting to learn, so rather than just throwing all the warriors up front, they're like, okay, right, we're going to get the destroyers out to and I love the fact that, because there's so much gauze weaponry firing in this sort of cavern, that it starts heating the cavern, like the whole, like the cavern starts glowing red from the heat that's going on in there. Again, you can just visualize it. It's fantastic. Mm,
yeah. And also, because Oberon's in the forefront of the fighting, because he's the faithful Vanguard, well, Vargard, but he's also in the Vanguard. His visceral reaction to seeing destroyers is really interesting, because it turns out quite a few Necrons really don't like destroyers because they are messed up. No one wants to be around the guys who are literal genocidal maniacs when you're just trying to do your job.
Yeah. And I think it transpires as well that Zandrak doesn't actually use them. Part of his tactics, he refuses to use destroyers as well, which is quite an interesting little fact as well. Again, it's all, despite his, you know, his insanity, is the fact he still will acknowledge what he can and can't, you know, will not use.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic.
I mean, from his standpoint, it'd be like, yes, I'm running a very honorable, because he's all about honor, I'm running a very honorable army here. I'm not going to include that one unit of soldiers who comes back from every battle drenched head to toe in gore, carrying severed heads, and laughing about how many guys they killed. That's not honorable.
No.
I love soldiers like Oberon, who do their job and listen to me.
Yeah,
exactly. And stuff like that. What we should also discuss is why this particular tomb world is severed, because it's not the traditional method. The problem with this tomb world is Necrons were meant to be asleep for about 60 million years.
Yep.
In this particular tomb world, one lone Kryptek woke up at about the 30 million year mark, I think it was, or something like that. And then proceeded to spend the next several million years completely alone as just the only sentient creature on an entire planet. And he went absolutely insane.
Yeah.
this entire tomb world from top to bottom is covered in writing because he's just been scratching things in the wall. Again, over an entire planet.
Yeah.
He has scratched stuff into the walls.
Well, he's got a lot of time on his hands.
Yeah, he's got a lot of time on his hand. when Zandrex first sees the Severed, he has like a real system shock. Like he seems to notice reality for a moment. It's like, they're us, but they're severed, and it really freaks him out. He seems to go into this big spiraling depression. Mm-hmm. But the plot point is he's actually spending all his time translating this scroll, because the Kryptek was writing out a formula to transfer Necron souls out of the robotic bodies to somewhere else. And this is deliberately vague, but I'm going to posit that this somewhere else is into humans, and this is where the pariah gene initially came from.
Yeah, you could be right on that. It's sort of suggesting it's like reverse engineering the process they went going from Necron tier to Necron. So it's basically, like I said, taking them back out of their metal shells into flesh and blood.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason the tomb world is severed is the Kryptek succeeded. He built this engine in the center of the Tomb World, sucked the mind and soul out of every single Necron on it, and sent them, again, just quote-unquote, somewhere else. And yeah, so the autonomous spirit completely took over everything because there were no Necrons to run anything, so it had to run everything itself.
Yeah.
I'm steering hard into that's the reason pariahs exist, but who knows? We'll find out eventually.
Yeah.
Maybe. I would love that to be that. I want Nate Crowley to write a big full book about pariahs and have that be the reason, because he deserves it after this.
Definitely.
Yeah. What else? Shall we talk about the real twist here? True twist about this, about these characters. The best bit of the book. Three words. You old bastard.
Yeah.
I never expected a Necron to say.
Yeah, because like I said, we've had this whole, you know, this whole book so far. And like we said earlier with Xandrax being, you know, suffering with dementia and going on his own path. And obviously Oberon having to deal with this. But it, you know, it basically hints, well, transpires that he actually is putting on a front with all this. Reality is he does know what's going on, but he's actually, it's almost like for the greater good, not that greater good. It's almost like he realizes that by portraying that, you know, that he still thinks he's Necrontyr and everyone else is just other Necrons trying to take over, not other races, that it basically almost keeps him where he is. Because I think that sort of if he gave away that he did actually know what's going on, that's where his rivals would want to, you know, would probably try to take him down. It's like almost like, it's like it basically creates a safe zone for him because, it's just old, insane Xandrek. Luckily, he's a really good general. Let's just pander to his, you know, his crazy whims and memories of times past. It sort of, keeps him where he's at. And it felt a bit like, if you've seen the ending of spoilers, the ending of Shutter Island, if you've seen that. It's sort of like that where, you know, when DiCaprio's character sort of goes back to, because, you know, realizes he sort of comes back to reality that he's actually in a mental institution, and it's like, and then sort of at the end, does he actually, he regresses back into it, or does he actually know? And it's, you know, it's like that. It's that sort of situation. It felt like anyway.
And it's for like a strategic benefit. Sure. It's also, I think, for his own personal enjoyment, because the quote is, because this quote is beautiful. I'm going to read it out.
Yeah, go for it.
Even if we all cease to be flesh and blood millions of years ago, which of course I don't believe for a moment, Xandrek actually winked. Wouldn't it have suited us better to live in denial of that, as some fools might say I had done? Wouldn't it be better, Oberon, just to accept our fate and enjoy immortality for the everlasting life of merry campaigning it has proved to be? He's loving life.
Yeah.
He's like the one happy Necrontyr. He's like, All I was ever good at was running battles. I really enjoy doing that. I'm immortal now. I can do that forever.
Yeah. which is lovely in a way. It's almost like it's taken advantage of what ended up for them being what they would probably argue is a horrible situation. Because I know they were tricked in the end, going from the Necrontyr to the Necrons, and I suppose they've had the advantages. Again, they're immortal and they can repair themselves, etc. But then, obviously, like I said, they've lost their memory, you know, depending on who you are, but they've lost their souls literally and their memories, etc. Yeah. So I suppose he's looking at it as, well, I get the best of both worlds. I've still got my memories. I still remember being a Necrontyr. Like you said, I can still be a great general, which is my favorite thing in the whole world. And I get to be immortal at the same time. I will just won't tell you now, so I realize that.
And like he's really insistent about this, because at the end of the book, Oberon's desperately begging him to at least try and use the machine to change the Saltec dynasty back. He's going, no, don't be silly. Don't be foolish. This is just nonsense. It never worked. Don't look at the machine that could turn us back into flesh bodies. It's all lies. We're flesh already. Don't you believe me?
Yeah.
Exactly. Please let me stay like this.
So good. Like I said, I'm nothing about this novella disappoints me, even though I didn't have any expectations before going in. But I just, it's all these lovely bits. It all melds so together. And I imagine if you're listening to this and you've not read it, it sounds really strange, this novella, because we're talking about Necrons. But yeah. It works. Honestly, we can both agree on that. It works.
Absolutely. It's so good. Yeah. I want a full Zandrek novel. It'd be so nice.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. I feel this is like the perfect interpretation of a good Zandrek story. Mm. Like, I feel a novel would just be this but longer, but I want that.
Yeah. Oh, that's the thing. I could happily have them going on their adventures as a series of books. Yeah. I would love this. You know, the Zandrek and Oberon show. I'd love it.
Oh my god. Please let Zandrek and Oberon become the next Commissar Kane.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It'd work, or like Kallus and Tol in AOS. Mm, it's like, you know, they just work as a pair, and I would happily watch it. Or read it, I should say. But no, it's really cool. I was going to say, is there any last bits you wanted to focus on?
Necron technology is terrifying. They can slip between atoms to get behind you. I don't like it.
Yeah. I was going to say, also, Oberon's got that, is it a Ghost Walk mantle, which is a really cool name. Yeah. He's got this like teleporter, which can still teleport through, even through like the suppression that they're dealing with on the planet. Because obviously the Tomb World has gone into sort of fight mode. Obviously, that it started bringing out technology, which is basically stopping the Necrons beaming down to the planet. So they haven't done it the old fashioned way of like getting into flyers and flying down. But he's got, this Ghost Walk mantle, which allows him to basically beam anywhere he really wants, which is really cool as well. Nice little bit of tech. He's deceptive. He's got cool tech on him. He's got Chronosense. He's got his Ghost Walk mantle. He's got cool stuff. Cool. Okay. Well, that has been Severed. Again, like we said at the start, go and read this, because it's what part of the novella series. It's £3 over here, so it's, you know, it's dirt cheap. It's about 100 odd pages. You can, you know, read it in a few sessions. It's so worth it. And especially, like I said, now we're heading towards the new edition of 40K, which is obviously going to have a focus on Necrons. This is a perfect bit of literature to get you in the mood for Necrons.
Absolutely.
Cool. Right. Okay. Well, we'll take our last little break now, and then we're going to slip over to the Mortal Realms and talk about some of our favorite pets. Oh, bless. Back soon. And we're back. We're back to talk favorite pets. Never. Yeah, we thought we'd get nice and fluffy for the last part of this show, because obviously that's what you associate with Age of Sigmar, is fluffiness. So for this discussion topic, like I said, we're going to pick some of our favorite pets. I mean, obviously pets is a funny term, obviously, in AOS, because obviously it depends what you mean by that, really. But there's some cool little creatures out there that often get sort of forgotten about, I feel, because obviously they end up often being part of another model sometimes as well.
Yeah.
So they often get forgot about. So, Cameron, tell me, what are some of your favorite pets in these Mortal Realms?
I'm going to lead on with my most recent pet from the Mortal Realms, which is in the Wormspat, old Granny Wormspat herself, I forget her name. She has a little thingamajig on her base called a Wretchling, which is just a nurgling but a cat, and I love it so much. It's so cute. It's got this vile little face. It's all poxy and mangy. It's so sweet.
See, I suppose for you, it sounds a match made in heaven. As a cat lover and a Nurgle lover,
exactly.
That comes together, really well.
Mm. Does it come with tetanus? More, please.
Yeah. Well, that's what the cat should come with, surely, in the Mortal Realms.
I mean, we already have cat scratch in reality. I'm sure getting scratched by a cat in Age of Sigmar would be even worse.
I can imagine, yes.
Shall we alternate?
Okay. I'm going to go for the Bitter Grub. Now, the Bitter Grub is familiar if you know the Branch Witch model for the Sylvaneth. So basically, the Bitter Grub is the lovely little creature on our shoulder. Basically, I suppose is like your own inbuilt little bodyguard, you know, sort of, not quite similar to Zandrak and Oberon that we were talking about a minute ago. But yeah, it's basically this lovely oversized insect with only bone lacerating mandibles and a temperament to match, you know, the branch witch as well. Cause obviously, as we know with Sylvaneth, they always feel like they're constantly angry. They're always pissed off. And what's worse than a pissed off witch, you know, a tree witch, when she's got a pissed off little insect on, well, not little, it's actually quite a big insect on her on her shoulder. So basically, you know, I like it because it's like you've got this own your own inbuilt defense system. And again, it's just it seems very Sylvaneth, not just because it's an insect, but also it again it's quite nasty. It's like you can just imagine, you know, you'd sort of get close with this branch witch, you're having a fight with it, and it just nips at you. I can just imagine it could just nip at your nose if it wanted to.
It looks like the worst thing in the world, which is a bobbit worm. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I've heard of them. What are they like?
They look exactly like the bitter grub. So imagine the bitter grub, but it buries itself vertically in the sand with just the teeth sticking out like a little trap.
Mm-hmm.
And then if a fish swims over it, that fish will end up in two pieces getting dragged down into the sand below. And they're obviously named after a very famous incident in which a woman, Mrs. Bobbitt, removed her husband's genitalia because they look like they could do that. And apparently they show up in aquariums a lot because they like to hide in rocks. So if you get rocks for your saltwater aquarium, you can accidentally get a bobbit worm in there, in which case all your very expensive fish go missing.
In pieces.
It looks exactly, it's got like those little trap jaws. It's got that segmented armored little body. It's very sweet. Did you fall in love with it when you read Garden of Mortal Delights? Is that what
I always hark back to that short story because I feel it's one of the most inspiring short stories from a visual, you know, when you're trying to imagine things point of view. I think with the bitter grub, especially the model, it's easy to actually almost forget it's there. And I think, and I swear in Silver Tower, I swear it actually was a separate piece, or you could, a lot of people use it as separate pieces, whereas obviously in the main model now, it's, and actually if you look at the artwork for the branch witch for Soulbound as well, the bitter grub is a big boy, or girl. It's a huge thing. I can just see it when you're fighting a branch witch, that it would just be like before the fight, when you're arguing, because obviously branch witches are pissed off, so you're probably going to have to get in an argument with it. I can imagine it being hidden, and then all of a sudden, click of the fingers, here we go, here's some mandibles for you. So yeah, that's one of my favorites. I think they're cool.
Excellent. I'm going to go to my second one. I'm going to pick the little, I forget the exact name of it, but it's the little hunting drake that comes with the the blood sisters for the Daughters of Cain, the Melusine.
Okay,
If you build them with the bows, which are the blood stalkers, not the blood sisters. Thanks, Brain. Remember my Daughters of Cain stuff suddenly. the leader can have a little drake, which is just, it's a little snake with wings and a little more dragony head just wrapped around her arm. And it is honestly very cute. Its claim to fame is it's the only halfway decent melee weapon in the squad. and even then, it's not particularly good, but hey. Something about the idea of these snake ladies having a tiny winged snake as a pet is incredibly cute to me, and I love it.
I can say, again, I suppose it's like with a lot of these pets, is they, honestly, I'm not saying they feel out of place, but it's almost like you forget they're there, and actually they're quite a nice thing to accompany whatever unit or hero you're talking about. Like, there's always like a good, it's like, oh yeah, that's a really good idea, because, you know, that's a cool purpose for that pet. And that's the way it should be. They're not just all show. They're there to do a job as well.
This is war. You can't just bring a pet randomly into a war.
Exactly. It needs a war pet.
It's a war pen.
Yeah. Oh, well, actually, talking of war pets, my next choice is on the Disciples of Tzeentch, and that's a Volchark or Volkark. Basically, that's the Acolyte's bird, you know, that you see in the box set. So basically, these are really cool because obviously, being the changer of ways, there's obviously that whole, you know, wizard and magic focus. And what I like about these birds is their purpose is to go, you know, weave in and out of the enemies, you know, to particularly look for enemy, you know, spellcasters. And obviously what happens if you need to, you know, incant your spells, but you can't do that if your eyes and tongues are taken out. Hence that's what the birds do. They go along and then they nip at the tongues and eyes of wizards so they can't cast spells. Jeez. Tragic.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's really nasty.
Wow. Yeah. Those always did look really cool. Okay, I've got my last one. My last one is a pet that you can't forget about. You can't miss this pet. Because my most favorite, this is absolutely my most favorite pet in Age of Sigmar to date, is Mulch. Mulch, if you're unaware, is the snail that Horticulus Slimox rides.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And he has the world's dopiest expression. He looks completely dumbfounded to start with, even if he's got, like, human teeth, which is not great for a snail to have, let's be honest. But the only way he is controlled is Slimox has a Nurgling on a stick, which he holds in front of the snail to steer it. It just follows this Nurgling on a stick around. This is serious business. He's here on Nurgle's business, but if he wants to get anywhere on time, he has to have this snail dragging a plowshare behind it, being literally Nurgling and sticked forward to just...
Oh, it's just the humor of Nurgle.
It's so perfect. Like, to a minor Nurgle, but that's just... Nurgle's got all the cute stuff. Like, if this was 40K, it would have gone to Sassy Nurgling, of course.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
that's true. So everyone knows that
Fair
one.
Fair point. I'd say my last one would probably be the Fangmora eel. I know that's a mount, but technically it's a pet as well.
Yeah, I mean, the blanking. That's a pet.
Yeah, exactly. It's cool. It's got a lot going for it. You know, it looks cool. Mm-hmm. It can basically take, let's say, bioelectricity and sort of course it through the rider's weapons. I mean, that's cool by itself. If you can take the electricity from your mount and turn that into a weapon, is, well, that's badass in my opinion, really. And I like they got that temperament as well, because again, I always feel sometimes when you see the Deepkin, they look a bit passive sometimes, and you think, oh, they're just they're just sea elves, whereas underwater elves, really. And no, you know, they're riding nasty mounts, you know, they're not all cute turtles, you know, they've got these eels. And yeah, I just like them. I just think that they're one of my, I know they're one, you know, tabletop, they're one of the best Deepkin units, but I think aesthetically and the fact that, you know, like, I think I remember in what was it called, the Deepkin novel Court of the Blind King, covered, and wasn't there the Deepkin lady that tries to, that, you know, is responsible for capturing him, and she's missing like limbs and things, for all the dangerous side of that. So I really like that. I like the fact that they're not, you can't just easily tame them. You know, it's it can be painful to do. Absolutely. So.
And they're like a really good, they're a really good callback to Cold One Knights in Warhammer Fantasy as well.
Yeah.
Cause if this was Warhammer Fantasy favorite pets, it would absolutely be Spite, which is Malice Darkblade's Cold One.
Yeah.
So perfect. And yeah, the Fangmora are like the modern ish equivalent. Like, there is the Order Draconis, which are just Cold One riders, but
yeah,
but it's not the same.
Yeah. I agree. Cool. I was going to say, is there any, I know that we've covered the ones we like, but is there anything you would like to see in AOS pet-wise?
I want to see. So the Lumineth Realm Lords gave us a lot of unexpected things, and one of the really unexpected things was a battle cow. I want to see a Lumineth Realm Lord with a regular cow as a pet. Like, just not, maybe not a big cow, but like a little calf or something, is like, it could be like He could be a priest or something. He's like, yeah, we worship Teclis and Tyrion as the lords of the harvest of light, man. So we bring the bounties of the harvest to the battlefield, and they empower and heal our troops. I'm like, that would be hilarious and also really cute.
Yeah.
And another topical thing, this is just the upcoming Age of Sigmar stuff. Sons of Bayomat should have pets, which is... Yeah. They should have humans that they are not actively squishing.
Like, yeah.
If I saw Sons of Bayomat and he had like a little bird cage around his neck, and in the bird cage was just a little sort of depressed looking human that's not like actively trying to get out, just sitting there with like a little bit of food and like a wineskin, just like, well, I guess this is me now. I'm this giant's pet human. I think that would be amazing.
That'd be great. I like that. We may see it. Who knows? Yeah, there may be benefits to having, you know, little humans alongside them. That'd be awesome. which I think what I'd want. I know this is all going back to very recently, but I would love to see those Sylvaneth hounds that we read about in Dark Harvest.
Oh, God.
They'd just be badass. Be so cool.
Yeah.
They would be nasty. And actually, talking of hounds, I would like, this is a really random one, but I would like alternative flesh hounds for Khorne. Because I like flesh hounds, I think they're cool, but I'd like ones that, I don't know, they can go invisible or something. Like something really weird tricks. I know that's probably wouldn't happen because it's Khorne, therefore that'd be more Tzeentch. But actually, yeah, let's have some Tzeentch hounds, you know, sort of things. I'd like all the Chaos, armies to have hounds of some sort. I know they sort of, you know, you've got your fiends, you've got your Seeker mounts and such, but actual proper hounds, but like that do different things depending on which Chaos god they're aligned to.
That'd be cool. Hell yeah.
Yeah. Someone do it. Someone probably has already done it. But So that's been our favourite pets of AOS. Now, as you're listening, you're thinking, what's my favourite pet, aren't you, to yourself? You're like, well, what pets do I like in AOS? And that's why you listen, because we hit the real hard topics here. That's been episode 55. Hope you've enjoyed it. So we'll sign off now. Cameron, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on the Twitter at @knight_twitten. That's knight without a K. Come join me for sharing various things related to our turbulent times, and also pictures of extremely cute kittens, because cats are very cute and I love
not them. Nurgle ones, though.
Not Nurgle ones. These cats are very healthy and happy. So they're halfway there. They just need to be less healthy, and then they'll be Nurgle cats, I guess.
Okay.
So for soft kitty content and the occasional core, the Australian government is terrible content, come follow me on Twitter. Nope, it's gone. Or you can follow me on Instagram at realm_and_ruined to see just my hobby progress and nothing else, if that's what makes you happy. I've got some stuff to put up on there. I've got to start updating that more frequently. I kind of forget I have Instagram for several days at a time usually.
That's fair enough.
And wherefore can we find yourself, Matthew?
You can also find me on that Twitter.com as well, at NinjaBadger7, which unfortunately I don't really do much on because I'm busy on the Realm and Ruin Twitter page, which is at Realm and Ruin, which is where you can find our podcast, which is obviously showing off what we're doing, latest news, any funny things that we see. So come along. And like I said earlier in the show, come along and join our Discord. It's full of lovely, gorgeous people. Absolutely. So hope you've enjoyed this episode. Stay safe out there. Be nice to each other. And as always, we'll catch you on the next one. Bye.
Bye-bye.